Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Decades ago, I said that, you know, I didn't know much about Brazil, still don't. But from what I heard from people who had been there, or people who were from there, because I'd heard a long time ago that outside of Africa, the largest population of black people is in Brazil. But you don't ever see them on television, even on the Brazilian programs. It's every now and then, I mean, somebody will pan the camera, and you'll spot them on the at Mardi Gras time. But where are they the rest of the time when they make the advertisements and do all the hoopla and whatnot? You wouldn't think that it's, you know, it was just, you would think that there's just a smattering of black people in Brazil. I mean, when I say black people, the black people that look like black people in Central Africa. Mm-hmm. But the numbers are huge. But they all push back up in those hills. But when it comes to classification, from what I understand, Brazilians will tell you, we don't have any discrimination here. You know, everybody's the same. Color don't make no difference here. This is Brazil.
This next story underlines a big reality of race in the world. Race is a social construct. It's not really a matter of genetics. We're all one species, after all, and our ancestries tend to be mixed. Your racial identity is either what you say it is or else what society imposes on you.
And this story is about a society that's changing the rules. In the multi-ethnic, multiracial nation of Brazil, race was traditionally up to the individual. If a Brazilian said she was black, she was black.
But that's now changing. In order to meet the conditions of affirmative action, candidates will have to go in front of special race tribunals. NPR's Lulu Garcia-Navarro reports.
When the test scores came out, 27-year-old Lucas Siqueira was really excited. His top score in the Foreign Service exam had earned him a coveted position at Brazil's highly competitive Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
They hire about 30 diplomats a year, and then thousands of people sign up.
So it was a great day. Siqueira considers himself to be mixed race, known as pardo in Brazil, or brown, which he was required to write on his application form.
I consider myself to be a very typical Brazilian, and I've always been very proud of it. And in my dad's family, I have my grandfather is black, my grandmother has Indian and white roots. On my mother's side, they are mostly white, mostly Portuguese.
How he defines himself matters because of affirmative action rules for spots in government jobs here. The problem came once the announcement was made. People on the internet started investigating. They got into his Instagram, his Facebook feed, and they sent his personal photos to the government.
A lot of people sent pictures like, oh, this dude is white, he's a fraud.
People basically said that he was gaming the system, lying about who and what he was to get one of these coveted jobs. The government was getting so much flack that they put Siqueira's offer on hold. And then they set up a race committee, which is what it sounds like. He showed up and there were seven diplomats in a room who were there to decide if he really was Afro-Brazilian. They asked him a few questions like,
since when do you consider yourself to be a person of this color?
And then it was over. What they had decided was that he was not pardo or mixed race. No explanation, no discussion. So he decided to sue. And that's when the story gets even more complicated, because in order to prove that he was Afro-Brazilian, there needed to be some kind of objective criteria. He went to 7 dermatologists who used something called the Fitzpatrick scale that grades skin tone from 1, the whitest, to 7, the darkest. The last doctor even had a special machine.
Apparently, on my face, I'm type 4, which would be Jennifer Lopez, Dev Patel, Freda Pinto, or John Stamos. And on my limbs, I would be type 5, which is Halle Berry, Will Smith, Beyonce, and Tiger Woods.
Like most people, he has different skin tones on different parts of his body. But in none of these tests did he come out as lighter skinned. Despite the controversy, these race tribunals a few weeks ago have been made mandatory for all government jobs. In one state, they've even issued guidelines about how to measure lip size and nose width and hair texture. Lieser Vas is a coordinator of the NGO Educafro, which works to open up access to education for Black Brazilians. He, like most Black activists here, supports the commissions. The reason, he says, history.
We are very far from the equality.
Brazil imported more enslaved Africans than any other country, some 5 million. The legacy of that period can still be felt today. Even though the majority of the population here is of African descent, 10 years ago, only 5% of Afro-Brazilians were in higher education. Because of affirmative action, that number is now 15%. Vaz says these are hard-won gains, but there is a long way to go.
Only 5% of executives are Black in Brazil. Politician, diplomat, all of things. So the Black people don't access space of power in my country. This is the real issue we have.
He says, unlike the USA, where race is determined by parentage, in Brazil, he says, the criteria is different.
Who is more affected by racism? Who has the chance to be affected by this in this country?
Ultimately, he says, it is messy, but Brazil is trying to right a historic wrong.
It's controversial, but the general result is good because we are giving a chance for poor Black people to access a space of power that we never have had this in Brazil.
Lucas Siqueira, who's still waiting for his case to be resolved, says he understands that there is racism in Brazil, but he says identity is made up of more than just physical characteristics.
I think we're going down a very dangerous path if we want to institutionalize these kinds of racial tribunals, actually.
He says he sits in the middle, not white, not Black, and now not embraced by either side. Lulu Garcia Navarro, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
My president is Black, in fact, he's half white. So even in a racist mind, he's half right. If you have a racist mind, you be aight. The president is Black, but his house is all white.
York is in some hot water over controversial posts on Facebook. Many people who've seen them calling them racist and offensive to Jews, Muslims, and women. Don White digging deeper tonight.
Things could get heated here at the next West York Borough Council meeting. At least one council member will ask the mayor to resign.
Thank you, guys.
An emotional West York Borough Councilman Brian Wilson getting comforted by other council members. He's calling about a dozen of Mayor Charles Wasco's Facebook posts disgusting and will make a motion for his resignation at the next meeting.
I have family members who are of other ethnic groups, and I was never raised this way. I don't believe in hate.
This post on the mayor's page, a group of monkeys in a wheelbarrow with the words, "Moving day at the White House has finally arrived."
Damn you, Obama.
Chuck is way out on the limb, and I honestly think he should apologize immediately. I have had members of the public reach out to me last night and all day today, hundreds, asking for his resignation.
The mayor also shared posts the council says are offensive to Jews, Muslims, veteran, and women. He did not return our messages for comment.
It does not represent any member of council. We do not condone his actions and what he said. And it's not representation of the police department or any departments in this borough. He's on his own on this one, and he just needs to step down.
It's no longer Mayberry. It's no longer all whites. It's all of us. We're all together.
The meeting will be held right here next Monday at 6 in the evening. The council does expect the NAACP and Black Lives Matter to attend.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
Details out today as the yelling of racial slurs led a Mizzou fraternity to be suspended. That new information is coming from the police report of the racial confrontation with other students outside the Delta Upsilon house. News 4's Courtney Bryan sorted through that report this afternoon and the new complaints about how campus police responded. Courtney?
Right, Claire. A major complaint here wasn't the racial slurs themselves or the incident itself, but the way campus police handled it, some saying they even used excessive force. It comes as Mizzou is in the midst of repairing its image after racially based campus demonstrations made national headlines last year. But now we're getting a closer look at how police describe this situation. A total of four campus officers responded. It all started when two women from the Legion of Black Collegians, approached an officer just before midnight Tuesday. They pointed out someone in a group walking nearby and said that person called them a racial slur. When the officer confronted the group, it was in front of the Delta Upsilon house. That's when police say fraternity members inside the house got involved in a heated argument with students outside. Officers say both groups yelled racial slurs at each other at that point. And at one point, black students complained the fraternity members played rap music to taunt them. Police say two black students and six white students were involved. It's still unclear about allegations an officer used excessive verbal force with a hand on his gun while trying to calm one of the women who was harassed. However, this whole incident is under investigation by Mizzou's Title IX office and Office of Student Conduct. In the newsroom, Courtney Bryant, News 4.
Let's go to the point of false equivalency, because I think this is very relevant to what you're talking about, and I have one more fucking idiot I want to get to. I tweeted he's a fucking idiot, and he is, Colin Kaepernick.
Thank you. High five on that one.
Yeah, but not for the same reason.
Okay.
Yeah, he is. He is. He's a fucking idiot. I'm for his protest. For the taking the knee. But here's what he says on race. You have Hillary, who was called black teens or black kids super predators, and you have Donald Trump, who's openly racist. This is the false equivalency. He says both are proven liars, and it almost seems like they're trying to debate who's less racist. Okay, they're not both proven liars. PolitiFact has looked at this, okay? She lies less than most politicians. He lies more than anyone they've ever seen.
70+%. That's right.
And they're not both racists.
Yeah.
Donald Trump is a racist. Hillary Clinton works her whole life for the opposite.
Well, first off, I want to say my name is Michael Rose Ivey. I'm a student athlete at the University of Nebraska. You know, as everyone is aware, this past Saturday before the game against Northwestern, Deshaun Neal, Muhammad Berry, and myself kneeled in solidarity with Colin Kaepernick and many other athletes across the country, both professional and non-professional, who are standing together to use their various platforms to bring awareness about police brutality and the recent death of black men and women at the hands of police officers. While the anthem played, I prayed along with Deshaun and Muhammad, and we asked God to watch over us and protect us, to look down on this country with grace and mercy, and to look down on all of us with grace and mercy. Those who are continuously told it is their fault that their problems exist, that only if they do better, then they will have better, that if you just pull up your pants, et cetera, you can fill in your own what if, but it's not so simple. It's not so clear. I can say that with confidence because even though I have done better, even though I am a college graduate, even though I am blessed and fortunate to play college football at the highest level and at one of the most prestigious college football schools in college football, even though I am a healthy being and even though I am fully conscious, I have still endured racism. I was still referred to Facebook and Twitter as a clueless, confused nigger who by former high school classmates, friends, peers, and even Husker fans. Some believe Deshaun, Muhammad, and myself should be kicked out of the team or suspended, while some said we deserve to be lynched or shot just like the other black people that have died recently. Another believed that since we didn't want to stand for the anthem, then we should be hung before the anthem for the next game. These are actual statements we received from fans. People assume that this is just internet talk, but I can tell you from my own experience at this very institution and visiting other college campuses within the past 4 years that racism is still a problem that must be addressed. I can't tell you the numerous amount of times I've heard the N-word being shouted at my teammates tonight from opposing fans behind our bench. My freshman year, I could remember going to a frat party and was told that niggas are not allowed in this house. We were escorted out several minutes later by security officers. People want athletes like Deshaun, Muhammad, and myself to remain silent and just play football. However, we cannot ignore the lives that we've lived. We as black athletes cannot remain silent. We are fully aware that football consumes only a small part of our lives, as we are often reminded football doesn't last forever.
And new developments tonight in those national anthem protests. Several NFL players and now Nebraska Cornhuskers say they've recently received racially charged blowback for their statements. Senior linebacker Michael Rose-Ivy says he and two freshmen took a knee during the anthem at Northwestern Saturday to highlight racial injustice. On Monday, Governor Ricketts called their protest disrespectful, but condemned the comments threatening violence against the players. In his radio call today, Husker coach Mike Riley called on Husker fans to respect the players' right to free speech.
Everybody should be reminded that you know, there's lots of differences in people. I've got 140 kids on the football team, and they're all different in their own beautiful way. And I think that everybody should be reminded that this is America, and we have opportunity and a right to be able to, you know, basically say what we feel.
And former Omaha mayor and current University of Nebraska Regent Hal Dobb says his comments about three Husker players were misinterpreted by a Lincoln newspaper. Our Colin Rain just talked with one of the University of Nebraska Regents about the controversy. Colin.
John, I met with Hal Dobb within the last 45 minutes, and while he tells me he does disagree with the move by those three Husker players, calling it disrespectful, but he tells me he did not say they should be kicked off the team as a result of it. That's contrary to a quote from him in the Lincoln Journal Star, where he's quoted as saying they'd better be kicked off the team. Dobb himself is a veteran and says the national anthem is a time-honored tradition, and now, this whole situation really took off during the game at Northwestern this past Saturday. Since then, the story has generated a lot of debate on social media from both sides. But again, Dobb tells me this afternoon that quote in the Lincoln Journal Star is not correct. And John, will continue following this story and bring you the latest developments as soon as they become available.
I thank you, Colin. Colin Rain reporting live tonight.
We're asking the question, is there a need to revisit BEE policies or broad-based policies in South Africa to achieve transformation in the economy? And I've got two guests joining me for this debate. Nane Mutunzi, who's the president of the Black Management Forum. Thanks so much for coming to the studio.
Thank you for inviting us.
And then I've got Gerard Papenfuss on the line. Gerard, we haven't spoken in ages. Lovely having you back on the show. Chief Executive of the National Employers Association of South Africa. Thank you so much for taking time out, Gerard.
Hello, Sibia.
Great. In which case, I want to start with you, Mwane, because, you know, BEE, it's like when it comes to talk shows and debate in this country, it's like the gift that keeps on giving. It just divides all of us as South Africans. Some people think that BEE policies or triple BEE policies are inherently problematic. Some of us think it is good in terms of design, but the implementation is a mess. Where currently do you stand?
Yeah, the BMF, basically, we decided to try to resolve those sort of things. We want to put BEE and transformation in specifically at the center of what we're going to do. So that's why our theme of the conference is making transformation a business imperative. And among the sub-theme, and which has sparked interest, is the ownership as an engine for transformation. And it goes from the thesis that our former president, the late Lautenlof, would say that BEE is an engine for transformation, and ownership is an engine for BEE. Therefore, ownership is at the key at the core for transformation to be able to happen. So what we don't appreciate as South Africans is that without BEE, we would never have managed to have the middle class that we've managed to produce, the growth that we've managed to produce. Because it's precisely because of the elements within the BEE, whether it's Employment Equity Act with preferential procurement, which enables small enterprises to have an opportunity to do trade or to be part of a bigger supply chain of business, and to deal with issues of skills development, and to ensure that companies are conscious in terms of the environment and they participate and contribute to the communities that they make business in.
So if I understand you correctly, for you, it's an old debate that frankly should not be a debate whether or not BEE is necessary. For you, the question now is, how do we perfect it in terms of questions like ownership fronting? And we're going to get to those issues, but I just want to be clear. For you, BEE, in terms of whether it's desirable, that really is a debate that has come and gone.
So we can... I will be interested for anyone who is against BEE to tell us what is the alternative. And we haven't found the alternative to BEE, and therefore BEE remain the biggest instrument that has changed our society. It can be perfected to make sure that it gives us even much better desired outcomes.
Gerard, there are two parts to this debate, and I want to tackle them one, you know, each in turn. I am interested in the issues that Nane wants to talk about in terms of implementation, ownership, etc. But in a sense, that kind of discussion, which would be the second bucket of issues, only really interests someone who thinks that BEE is a good idea to start off with. Do you share the idea that BEE is essential to transformation?
That is, I think, it's common cause that we need to rectify the wrongs of the past. That's not even a question. If that's the term BEE, which in certain quarters has become a bit of a curse word to some extent, if that's BEE, that's BEE. Then nobody can argue with that, and I agree with my colleague. Nobody can argue that we need to uplift. There's wrongs that have done as transpired in the past, and we need to rectify. It is and it is the question of how to do it without prejudicing and jeopardizing the economy. That's the question. And I think when he says that ownership is key, I agree. But if that means transferring ownership from where it is currently to where he wants it, I mean, that is problematic, and maybe it is not, but maybe it is. We need to know what does he mean, because that is a very hot issue, because there's still a huge portion of the current economy is in white hands. Now, you know, we're in a black-white debate, and it's so unfortunate that we even need to mention it, but, you know, how can you get around it? And there's a huge amount small businesses that's currently in white hands, and it's family-owned business. SMEs are predominantly white, not white-owned, family-owned, not white-owned, family-owned. The moment you talk about ownership there, these people close shop. They say, but how can you? You know, you don't even give your business to your son. You don't give it to another white man for that instance. And a black man wouldn't just give it to another black man. It's such a contentious issue, and I think that is an issue that's really having a very negative effect on our growth at this stage.
Let me slow down and test your logic there, Gerard. I mean, you say it's a contentious issue. Why is it contentious to say that there's something deeply immoral and fundamentally unjust about an economy where the majority of businesses are still owned by white folks, even though they constitute less than 10% of the population? If you look at ownership patterns on the JSE, for example, if you look at senior management positions and appointments that are still made within corporate South Africa, for example, it is very clear that the demographics of the country are not reflected in those ownership patterns. Isn't the right conclusion there an uncontentious conclusion, which is that corporate racism is a real thing, even though democracy politically has been achieved? You describe it as contentious. I think it is uncontentious to say that the economy is fundamentally unjust.
Well, it may be so.
What do you mean, maybe so? I mean, do you honestly think the facts are disputable?
Well, okay, let's say it is so. How do you change it? But let's focus I'm not talking about companies that's listed. That's a different thing, and they listed companies do their thing. But let's talk about a company belonging to a white businessman. He's built it. And you go, and this businessman wants to access the market. He wants to have a contract with Eskom. And Eskom says to him, no, you cannot have this contract. You have to have a 51% black shareholding before you can have it. That guy will say, you know what? I'm just not interested. I cannot do it. And you know what he does? He simply focuses his attention to the markets outside. He reduces his company and makes it smaller. It is not that simple that anybody that knows anything about business will tell you, I can't just give my business. 51% shareholding is giving your business away. Now, you don't build a business in order to give it away eventually. So here's the question. If it is unfair, if it's unjust, the question is how to fix it. The economy is shrinking. We are trying to redivide a decreasing cake instead of building the economy. The world is losing interest in us because of this thing. So we can shout unjust as long as we wish. Nobody is going to invest in this country as long as it happens. So take then the businesses. So it's unjust. Take it. And then you see there's nothing left. I say there's got to be another model where the people that's currently in the economy has it's made attractive for them to build. They are closing shop. We are losing jobs by the millions, or hundreds of thousands at least.
Okay. I know how you respond to that.
Yeah. I think the problem we have is to... We talk past each other, and we don't want to acknowledge the reality of the situation that we live in. And the reality is that 40% of black people are unemployed compared to 6% of white people. Average household for blacks is 60,000 rand compared to 365,000 rand for white folks. And white people, they are 10% of the economic active population, and yet they occupy 70% of the top management leadership. And a black woman with a degree is unlikely to be a manager compared to a white man without a degree in South Africa today. So then if you have an answer to those problems, then put the solution. For you to say all these kind of excuses, by the way, is we're not getting anywhere. And the companies that we're looking at, by the way, we're not looking at family-owned businesses. And let's take a JSE-listed company. It's neither black nor white. It's a public entity, essentially. And those are the people we're talking about. And look what has happened. In 2012, the representation of black executives in top 40 JSE listed companies were 15%. That number has since been reduced to 9.8% last year when it was measured. And it means that we're going backwards instead of trying to move forward. So there's only part that I agree with Gerard on. It's a economic growth playing a bigger role in ensuring that we have a more equal society. But on skills and education, I wouldn't agree. They have the highest number of unemployed black graduates in this country. So it's not true that people don't have skills. And two things that I want to correct that Gerard has spoken about that are not factually correct is that black people are job hopping. In fact, white people job hop more than black people, but more black people are in the market. They just don't get opportunities as fast and quick as white people do. The second misperception that needs to be corrected is like black skills are expensive. It's not true. I've just quoted the numbers in terms of household income of whites being 365 compared to 60,000 of black household. Therefore, who earns more money? So those things are not factually correct. But we need to revisit the issue of economic growth. But it's not the answer. At some point, Eusebius, the economy in South Africa used to grow at about over 7%, and still transformation was not happening. So therefore, we'll come up with all sorts of excuses. Economic growth alone is not going to give us an answer. But I agree, we need to focus on it. It will make things better.
Racial tensions in Charlotte have escalated following the police shooting of an African-American man, Keith Lamont Scott, last week. Protests in the Queen City raised concerns about police treatment of minority citizens. Charlotte is an economic powerhouse in the South. It's the state's largest city, generates 30% of the state's GDP. It's home to big businesses like Bank of America. But as recent unrest demonstrates, Charlotte is a city struggling with racial and economic disparities, and those struggles often coincide with increased law enforcement presence. In Charlotte, black and Hispanic residents are roughly three times as likely to live in poverty compared to whites. And that is just one of the findings of a study earlier this year by the NC Poverty Research Fund at the UNC School of Law. And joining me now is the report's co-author, Gene Nickel, a distinguished professor of law at UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome back, Gene Nickel.
Thank you, Frank. It's nice to be here.
Also with me is Gumi Odson. He's a sociology professor at Northern Michigan University, and he published a study in 2013 that looks at the size of police departments in cities with high levels of racial and economic inequality. Gumi, welcome to The State of Things.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Gene Nickel, let me start with you and give us some of the bullet points in terms of racial and economic divisions in Charlotte.
Well, this is a very sensitive and complicated and wrenching problem, so bullet points are probably not called for, but I will do what you request, Frank. Let me just start by saying, as one who looks at poverty across North Carolina quite a bit, we traditionally think of poverty in North Carolina on a rural-urban axis, so that we know we have real challenges of poverty in much of rural North Carolina, particularly in the eastern part of the state, somewhat in the west. And then we have, on the other hand, these economic urban powerhouses, which are going like gangbusters. And that vision is true, but only as far as it goes, because what it fails to reveal is the most, when you look at it on a census tract basis or on a neighborhood basis instead of countywide or citywide, where averages can reveal or fail to reveal real challenges. The deepest poverty in North Carolina is right in the middle of Charlotte, right in the middle of Greensboro, right in the middle of Durham, right in the middle of Raleigh, right in the middle of Winston-Salem. So Charlotte is an economic powerhouse, a gem, but it has high rates of poverty. It has among the fastest increasing rates of poverty among the major cities in the United States. As you indicate, both income and poverty are very racially disproportionate or unbalanced. Maybe most troubling, one of things we concentrated most powerfully on in this report, is a growing, concentrated, racialized poverty which marks life in Charlotte. Lots and lots of poor people living together in close circumstance, which poses a real challenge for economic mobility.
Well, let me just stop you there for a second. The report showed that in 2014, for example, 70 out of 79 high-poverty tracts in Mecklenburg County were non-white.
Right, or were very highly majority-minority. So right. what we have in Charlotte is increased concentrated poverty, larger numbers of poor people living together in sort of closer proximity, which raises a whole kind of additional set of problems. It's a double whammy of sorts.
Double whammy.
Poor people have to live with their own economic challenges, and then they have to deal with the fact that lots of people around them are dealing with theirs as well, which sort of increases the magnitude of the challenge. Now, lastly, in this report, Charlotte also struggles, like much of North Carolina does, with a kind of structural problem. Charlotte creates a lot of jobs, a lot of great jobs, a lot of high-income jobs. It also creates a whole lot of low-wage jobs, close to minimum-wage jobs. It is losing increasingly the ability to produce middle-income jobs, and that's structurally increasing this polarization, which leaves a whole lot of people out.
Well, that's, I think, one of the key findings as well. It's not just that there's a lot of poverty. It's not that it is a poor city. It is a city with high concentrations of poverty and high concentrations of wealth and not a lot in the middle.
That's right.
Well, let me talk about that. You also make reference to another study a Harvard economist did when they looked at economic mobility in Charlotte. So, again, you know, one of the questions is, all right, you're poor, but we have this mobility and you can get out of poverty. And in Charlotte, it turns out that that is one of the least mobile cities in terms of getting yourself out of poverty in the state. And, in fact, the Harvard study showed in the country.
Yes, actually. And I know this has been distressing Ophelia's here, who is doing terrific work in Charlotte. This has been distressing to folks in Charlotte, but Professor Chetty's studies a couple years ago indicate that of the 50 largest cities in the United States, Charlotte has the worst economic mobility of all 50, last place, meaning that if you're born poor in Charlotte, you're more apt to stay that way than in any other major city in the country. There are a lot of reasons for that, a lot that we've looked at, and I would say, too, that that's very inconsistent with the way that Charlotte sees itself and wants to see itself, and so it has suggested a wide array of challenges.
Well, I want to take a look at the impact that this might have on policing and the way that is structured. Gumi Odson has done that at Northern Michigan University. Talk a little bit about your work for us. You looked at the size of police departments in cities with high levels of racial and economic inequality. What did you find?
So, to be more exact, we simply looked at U.S. cities with populations of over 250,000 or more, and we were doing that to predict, you know, what factors impact, so like the size of police forces. Okay, and we were of course looking at sort of like the relative size, so the number of sworn officers per capita in the thousands. So we're like comparing apples and apples. Okay, and so I want to, like, back up a little bit, okay? So in any society, there is need to maintain social order, okay? But how do you, like, maintain social order when there is great inequalities, you know, be it, you know, economic inequalities or racial inequalities or both, okay? And the hypotheses that we were testing, you know, derived from one school within sociology that argues that, you know, dominant groups in society, you know, feel threatened, you know, by racial minorities and by the lower classes, okay? And so we tested conflict theories, racial threat hypothesis, and the class threat hypothesis, okay? And to just, like, jump to the chase, we found that cities that have two things, okay, cities that have high degrees of poverty and racial economic inequality at the same time are most likely to increase their police forces, even after factoring in things such as the prevalence of crime, population density, innovative policing, like community policing. So this suggests, okay, and, you know, supports the claim that you know, elites or, you know, people that have economic and political power use formal social control through the police to, you know, help subdue a population that is perceived to be rebellious.
And this is interesting because, again, it doesn't happen. We don't necessarily, you didn't find that police forces expand where there are high rates of poverty and where perhaps there is a correlation between poverty and crime. If that's true, you might think, well, if there's more crime when there's more poverty, that's when we would increase our police department. The real increase happens when there is when there's poverty and disparity. That's when you see the increase.
And if you would allow me to elaborate a little bit, so we find that cities with great economic inequality between racial groups will not strengthen their police force if poverty is minimal, because less prosperous groups pose less of a threat to affluent groups if few live in poverty. However, cities with great poverty cities with great poverty will not heighten policing if economic inequality between racial groups is negligible, because less prosperous groups do not threaten more successful groups, quote unquote, if the economic disparities are small and poverty is widespread. It's when we have both of these things, high levels of poverty and great economic inequality between racial groups, this is when we see police forces, being expanded. It's because affluent groups feel threatened by groups who are worse off when there are both economic disparities between, the white dominant group and racial minorities, and many people live in poverty.
Canada. We should move to Canada.
There's been a lot of news once again this week in Canada about things happening south of the border in the United States, about men being killed by police officers in the United States. I'm talking, of course, about Keith Lamont Scott and Terrence Crutcher. May they rest in peace. Two men who should still be alive if it were not for the incredibly violent and inhumane actions of police officers in each of these individual cases. Now, if you have listened to the news at all this week, you know about this, because we in the Canadian media cover these stories. We cover what's been happening in North Carolina as a result, and the fact that people are out in the streets night after night protesting, furious at the fact that this continues to happen to black men in their country. We're having a conversation about policing, though, here in the city of Toronto also. And I always like to bring it back home, because we don't talk nearly as much about things that happen right here in this city as we do about things that happen in the United States. And I want to cite two examples of things that happened this week that I'm sure you probably didn't hear about. And they're cases of police shootings in this city that happened within the last several months. But it just so happened that this week, the Special Investigations Unit, which is that body that investigates any incident involving an assault, a killing, or a sexual assault involving a police officer in Ontario. Two decisions handed down by the SIU this week, both of them involving Toronto police, both of them involving Toronto police shooting individuals multiple times. And in both cases, no charges laid against the officers. In other words, the SIU determining, we looked at the facts and our opinion is that nothing criminal went on when these police officers shot civilians. One of these cases was documented in an article in the Toronto Star. It's actually a Canadian Press article. I should correct myself there. Two Toronto police officers who shot a mentally unstable woman armed with a meat cleaver several times after she threatened to harm her young son and paramedics last November won't be facing charges. That's the lead of this story. We don't know this woman's name, and although the article is not clear in the fact that she survived this incident, she did. But I imagine her life is irrevocably altered after this. What we understand from this story is that this woman was actually the one who called 911 herself. So I want you to imagine that. She is in mental distress, but she has the wherewithal to say, you know what would be the safe thing for me to do right now? It would be to call emergency services for help. That's what she did. Paramedics responded, but they left because she was brandishing a knife. So the paramedics left the scene. The police arrived. Now, according to the SIU, the police arrived. The woman was kind of standing around in her apartment, and her son, who she was in the room with, was also present. Now, this is a very obviously challenging situation for the police. But what happened? They say that the woman was actually, you know, at her sink. She was drinking a glass of water. The police were repeatedly telling her to drop the knife that she had in her hand, and she did not. And at that point, they say that she rushed at the police officers, whereupon she was shot three times. The SIU report, interestingly enough, it goes to the trouble of telling us that her son was not in the room when the shots were fired at her and hit her. It must have been a very, very short time frame from her son leaving the room and not being able to see his mom getting shot and those shots being fired. I also kind of wonder if she didn't have her son in the room anymore. Was there no other option? He wasn't in danger. That's what the SIU report says. She was shot 3 times and taken to hospital. She survived. No charges against the officers. Another incident, another very sad story, involves a 31-year-old man in Toronto who was shot 3 times by the police. And once again, the police officers were cleared in that situation in this case. This man, according to the SIU report, was in the hospital. He discharged from the hospital, but staff became concerned because they believed that they could smell alcohol on the man's breath. And so he left the hospital, but the hospital staff called the police saying, this man is just discharged, but we're worried that he has left intoxicated and we want to make sure that he gets home safe. So the man did get home safe, and the hospital staff called him and they said, we actually called the police to let them know we thought you were leaving this place intoxicated. We didn't want you to drive home drunk. And that made this man very upset. He told the hospital staff on the phone, I'm very upset that you called the police on me. Oh, and by the way, I have a knife. So officers arrive at the man's home. Remember, he made it home safely. That's the reason why the police were called. The fear that he was intoxicated. But he made it home. The officers arrived to his home. They say that they attempted to check on his well-being, but seconds later, the man walked out of the house holding a large knife in his right hand, and he pointed the knife at the officers. This guy was also shot 3 times. In both of these situations, the person who was shot was in mental distress, and either they called the police for help or someone else called to say, you need to go help this person. And each of them took 3 bullets from the police. The thing that really interests me about this second case, though, is that in the case of the 31-year-old man who was shot 3 times and also tased, by the way, the police wanted to bring in a mobile crisis intervention team. And we've talked about what those are, and they comprise of a mental health nurse and typically a specially trained police officer, which actually tells you something, because not all police officers are trained to deal with people with mental health issues. They have specially trained ones that are part of these mobile crisis intervention teams. So when they heard that this guy had maybe driven home drunk, was at home, in distress, they tried to call one of these teams to go talk to him instead of deploying the police. But that mobile crisis intervention team was not available. I believe that's because we only have 2 of them in the city of Toronto that are currently operating. We are about to spend $85 million on body cameras for the police. The idea being that incidents like this, where civilians get shot by the police, will be less likely to happen if the cops are wearing body cameras. $85 million? How many mobile crisis intervention teams could we have in the city of Toronto for $85 million? And wouldn't that be a much better use of our resources than body cameras that, as we keep seeing, can capture carnage, death, violence, but don't necessarily prevent it?
And I put the rifle in the safe, so we're not going to surrender to any mob. Then there was an old man out there started crying, man, just crying like a child, like a baby. He said, what is this country coming to? He said, the goddamn niggas got guns, and the police can't even arrest them.
And so that's where he got the title, Negroes with Guns. We're going to return now to a story that's captured public attention in recent days, the shooting of an African-American man named Keith Lamont Scott by police in Charlotte, North Carolina. It was one of two police shootings of black men recently that reignited the issue of public conduct toward African-Americans and prompted ongoing protests. Demonstrators gathered today outside the Bank of America Stadium in Charlotte before the NFL game between the Carolina Panthers and the Minnesota Vikings. And one of the issues cited by protesters was the refusal by Charlotte police to make police video of the encounter public. Yesterday, the police changed course and made some of the video public, and Police Chief Kerr Putney said the totality of evidence would make clear that the shooting was justified. Attorneys for the Scott family disagree. So we thought we would contact someone not involved with the case itself to try to understand some of the legal issues involved here. So we've called Joseph Kennedy. He's a professor at the University of North Carolina Law School at Chapel Hill. He teaches criminal law and criminal investigation procedure, and he is with us now. Professor Kennedy, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, first of all, I just have to ask the basic question. Do you think that the video makes clear whether this was a justified shooting or not?
No, it doesn't. I mean, I've watched it a couple of times, and you can't see a gun in his hands, but it's hard to tell whether there is anything in his hands at all.
One of the things that people who are critical of the shooting have talked about is the fact that North Carolina is a so-called open carry state. And so their argument is that Mr. Scott had a right to have a gun in his possession, even to have it in his hands, unless he was deemed to be doing something dangerous. So can you help us understand that? What does it mean to be an open carry state?
Sure. That means that, you know, you're allowed to carry a loaded weapon in public openly. You're not allowed to threaten anyone with it or brandish it in a threatening manner, but you can carry it. So yes, one of the issues that's definitely raised by this case is, you know, assuming that the police version of what happened is true, does smoking marijuana and having a gun in a public place mean that you were dangerous?
Just to clarify for people, the police, in addition to the video, released a rather lengthy statement where they describe the sequence of events from their point of view. And they say that they observed Mr. Scott rolling a marijuana cigarette, a blunt. They said that they were actually at this location in order to serve a warrant on someone else, so they did not consider this a priority. But at the point at which they observed a gun, called for him to put his gun down as he exited the vehicle. So that speaks to the question that you were raising, which is there anything in the law that says that you cannot both have marijuana and a gun at the same time?
Not specifically. So here's the question is, do the police have a reasonable suspicion that you're not just armed, but dangerous? So think about it in terms of three scenarios. Scenario one, the police see me littering and I have a gun on my hip. Scenario two, police see me breaking into a car with a crowbar and I have a gun on my hip. Arguably, the police are justified in pointing their guns at me in scenario two, where they see me committing what is a felony in North Carolina. And the reasonable fear would be that since I have a gun, maybe I'll use it to resist arrest for a felony. Scenario one, it doesn't seem reasonable to sort of draw their guns on me because littering is an infraction. The question is, where does smoking marijuana fit on that spectrum? Is it reasonable to assume that someone who's smoking marijuana and has a gun is also dangerous and is likely to resist a police contact with deadly force?
When does failing to comply with a police order justify the use of deadly force?
That's the million-dollar question. And the courts and the legislatures have refrained from laying out any sort of specific guidelines for police because they're afraid of sort of handcuffing and limiting the police in dealing with a difficult, stressful encounter that requires a split-second decision.
I think the thing that we're all trying to understand here is, from the standpoint of the laws of North Carolina and the practices of the Charlotte Police Department, what, if any, about Mr. Scott's conduct would prompt that level of response?
That's a great question. And I think the only answer that I see is that they assumed that the fact that he was smoking marijuana meant that he was involved in serious criminal activity. They've said that they were there to serve a warrant, you know, for a drug offense on some other individual. And it's too early to tell what they thought about, you know, Mr. Scott. If they suspected he was involved in serious criminal activity, well, that sort of individual sometimes might use deadly force to resist arrest. On the other hand, as you sort of pointed out, it's lawful to carry weapons openly in North Carolina. So simply having a gun, it means you're armed. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're dangerous. So the issue that's really raised is, how do we look at smoking marijuana? Does smoking marijuana give the police a reasonable basis to assume that you're a potentially serious violent offender, Or does it just simply mean that you're one of thousands of people in our state who do smoke marijuana, notwithstanding the fact that it's illegal?
Joseph Kennedy is a professor of law at the University of North Carolina Law School at Chapel Hill. He was kind enough to join us from his home office there. Professor Kennedy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
60 miles away, they had had the Tulsa riots years before I was born. But they never talked about them.
Never?
Slaughter. It was a slaughter. They never talked about it. The old folks never talked about it when I was in Oklahoma.
Wow.
I heard a rumor about it. I didn't know what to think.
Here's the scene in Tulsa yesterday.
Hands up, don't shoot! Hands up, don't shoot! Hands up, don't shoot! Hands up!
Protesters outside Tulsa's courthouse protesting last Friday's police shooting of an unarmed 40-year-old Terrence Crutcher after his vehicle broke down on his way home from class at Tulsa Community College. These incidents are alarming and familiar, but in the case of Tulsa, Oklahoma, the shooting of Terrence Crutcher cannot be separated from the echoes of an incident back in 1921, a race riot over 3 days which killed 300 people in a violent battle between whites and blacks that has few, if any, equivalents in American history. The Department of Justice and Oklahoma State authorities, by the way, have launched investigations into the current Tulsa shooting. Michelle Brown is the program coordinator at the Greenwood Cultural Center in Tulsa. She says there's no forgetting in Tulsa.
The racism that existed here during the race riot that, in fact, led to the race riot still exists. It is an inherited racism that has been passed down from generation to generation that has never truly been addressed. And while we see and hear people making racist comments and acting in a racist manner, when they are confronted about that racism, they deny being racist at all. So you can't address it or handle it, deal with it, if you're not even willing to admit that it exists.
So there's an honesty about history that Tulsa has failed to embrace, to deal with what happened in 1921 when 300 people were killed. The neighborhood in Greenwood, where you live, is that right?
Yes.
Was destroyed, looked like Aleppo in Syria. And now all that's washed over. And people in Tulsa, you could move into Tulsa tomorrow and never have any hint that that took place in 1921.
That's absolutely correct. If you were not to visit the Greenwood Cultural Center, where there are actually exhibits, you would not necessarily hear about it. And it's only been recently, within the last year or so, where they made it mandatory that it be taught in the public high schools in the history classes. However, they have a lot of leniency as to how much they talk about it. And many of the textbooks talk very little about or mention very little about the Tulsa race riot or Black Wall Street. There's always been an effort, and we've been talking about it for a little over 20 years. And there's always been an effort by people here to sweep it under the rug.
Michelle Brown, is the Holocaust taught in Tulsa public schools, the Diary of Anne Frank and that?
Yes.
Yeah. And work of Elie Wiesel, who says never forget in thinking about the Holocaust?
Yes.
And so why is it never forget with something like the Holocaust that happened in Europe, to a certain extent? I mean, even though it involved lots and lots of people spread all over the world, how come the message is never forget there? And in an incident that happened in Tulsa in 1921, it's, oh, we need to move forward. We need to leave that in the past. That forgetting is the healthy thing to do, it seems, as though certain people say. What do you say to that?
When we were attending Black history classes during my youth, we talked about slavery. We talked about the civil rights era, and they never mentioned the events of the Tulsa race riot or Black Wall Street. And I think that there's definitely some reluctance to talk about a history that people know that their ancestors, that their relatives may have been and could have been involved in. We still have two living race riot survivors. We identified 165 survivors in 1996. And some of the people that were here shooting and killing innocent, unarmed men and women were children. They were some of them were children of Ku Klux Klan members who had been armed and brought to Greenwood and given permission to kill innocent people and knew that there would be no repercussion. So people don't want to acknowledge this part of our history. They don't want to talk about it because they know that they could have direct relatives that were involved in the killing and murdering of innocent, unarmed people here in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
All right, Michelle, how do you think that history and the knowledge of what you're describing that took place almost 100 years ago can help in the community dealing with the killing of Terrence Crutcher?
I think that what's so troubling and frustrating for us as a people today is that we are still dealing with that same racism that is still evident in our police department as it was in 1921, because there were police officers that were participating in the riot. But it helps us to understand who we are and where we come from and what we're able to overcome as a people.
Michelle Brown is the program coordinator at the Greenwood Cultural Center in Tulsa, which explores the history of the race riot in 1921 that killed 300 people and ravaged the neighborhood of Greenwood. Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We begin today's show in Alabama, where prison officials have confirmed a group of correction officers refused to report for the evening shift Saturday at the Holman Correctional Facility in Atmore. The apparent work strike comes as guards have been walking off the job amid safety concerns and overcrowding throughout the summer. Prisoners say there are stabbings on a regular basis and call the facility the slaughterhouse. A guard stabbed by a prisoner earlier this month died last week. The warden was stabbed in March. This is incarcerated organizer Kinetic Justice speaking from inside the Holman prison on Saturday. Listen closely.
It's official. At 6 o'clock, no officers came to work. None came to work. None of the officers came to work. We have Deputy Commissioner Culliver, Warden Peterson, Sergeant Franklin from across the street. Warden Peterson from across the street. Warden Stewart, the captain, and a white guy, Wilson, and one other. Those are the only ones here running the facility. Right now, the commissioner is passing out trade. Warden Peterson is pulling the cart. Deputy Commissioner Culver passing out trade. Every cell, he passing out the trade. I can't believe it. To my black sliding shoes, brown knitted pants, white tweed shirt with the collar bust open, sweating at the temples. It's real. No officer came to work. They completely bucked on the administration. No more will they be puns in the game. Now time is going down.
Democracy Now! Reached out to the Alabama Department of Corrections to confirm reports of the strike by correction officers at the Holman Correctional Facility in Alabama. The department described the reports as unofficial and erroneous, but the department did confirm 9 officers did not report to work on Saturday.
The events at Holman come as the largest prison work strike in U.S. history has entered its third week. Organizers report that as of last week, at least 20 prisons in 11 states continued to be involved in the protests, including in Alabama, California, Florida, Indiana, Louisiana, Michigan, New York, Ohio, South Carolina, and Washington. The Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee says at one point about 20,000 prisoners were on strike. With the protests has come punishment, however. Several facilities were put on lockdown, with prisoners kept in their cells and denied phone access both before and during the strike. Organizers were also put in solitary confinement.
And Kinetic Justice is also joining us, co-founder of Free Alabama Movement, currently serving his 33rd month in solitary confinement at the William C. Holman Correctional Facility in Alabama. He's joining us by phone from inside the prison, inside Holman. Kinetic, let's start with you. Can you describe what's happening inside the prison right now? We just heard a clip of what you had to say about what happened Saturday night. What's happening with the guards? What's happening with the prisoners?
First of all, thank you for having me on the show, Ms. Goodman.
Actually, I want to address some things. On Saturday, on the second shift, no officers reported to work. That was confirmed by the Department of Correction spokesperson yesterday. However, they came back and tried to retract and to spin the story and said, no, only 9 officers on the third shift didn't come. But that just goes to show how out of touch the DOC spokesperson is with what's going on at Holman. Holman has had 2 shifts for the last decade. Officers work 12-hour shifts from 6 to 6. There is no third shift. To clear that up, as regards to what's going on now, obviously there were some concessions and some compromises made as yesterday there was almost an entire shift with extra officers from other facilities, overtime facilities. They actually had yard call for the first time in weeks. They actually ran the store. So they're trying to make some kind of concessions with the officers. So I can't speak directly to what those compromises were, but they did have almost a half shift yesterday, a whole shift with extra officers from other facilities.
And has there been any communication from the officers to the inmates in terms of why they are taking these actions?
Yes, yes, they're clearly communicating. For weeks we've been communicating back and forth. This administration really has no regard for human life, and they're beginning to see that it's not just directed at the men that are incarcerated here, that the violence that they've created actually spills over to these officers as well. And a lot of them are terrified of what's going on and refuse to go into the dormitories. A lot of times when they're calling codes for officers to respond to altercations, they're not coming, and these altercations are being broken up by people inside the dormitory. And there's a growing consensus in this place that if you don't have somebody that loves you or cares about you in the dormitory, then you're almost guaranteed to be a dead man because the officers are not coming to save you.
There are going to be a lot of arguments about the legal issues in the case. I'll let all the legal analysts and talking heads address those issues. The judge conducted the trial in a professional manner. The prosecution and the defense made their arguments in a case such as this. Reasonable doubt was relevant, and they rendered a verdict.
The dramatic verdict tonight in the mysterious murder case of a 12-year-old boy, the college soccer coach accused of strangling his ex-girlfriend's son. The judge's announcement rocked the child's family and divided a small New York town. Tonight, the defendant speaks out, telling a very different story than the prosecution. So who's telling the truth? Here's ABC's Elizabeth Vargas.
It's Judgment Day in a case that's prompted national headlines and divided a community. Nearly 5 years after the brutal murder of young Garrett Phillips, and after 3 weeks of trial, the accused, 42-year-old soccer star turned coach Nick Hillary, is about to hear his fate.
It is the judgment of this court that as to the charge of murder in the second degree...
2011, a rainy afternoon in Potsdam, New York. 12-year-old Garrett Phillips is heading home from school.
Tell me about his personality.
It just seemed like he was 100 miles an hour all the time. Soccer, lacrosse, hockey, football.
Wow, an all-around athlete.
Yes.
Until recently, Tandy and Nick had been a couple, even living together, which had raised eyebrows in the small town.
Do you feel like you stuck out?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. You know, sometimes you're the only one of color in the grocery stores.
That day in 2011, across the hall from Tandy's apartment, college students Sean Hall and Marissa Vogel hear something.
I said, did you hear that? We were both convinced that we had heard either no or ow, and then definitely a help. So I knew it was one of the children right away. It just sounded urgent.
Marissa goes to investigate, knocks on the door.
It was completely quiet until I heard a click of a lock. It was instant goosebumps.
Constant police.
My name is Marissa Vogel. I thought I heard screaming like no and help a couple of times.
When police finally get inside, Garrett Phillips is lying on the floor of his mother's bedroom.
Initially, my officers, they were focused on saving Garrett's life at that point in time. They didn't really know. They didn't know who they had or what they had. They called for medical intervention immediately, and that's when the emergency response began.
He is rushed to the hospital.
And then the shocking autopsy. Rug burns on Garrett's legs. Suspicious marks on his face and neck. The cause of death, suffocation and strangulation. 12-year-old Garrett Phillips was murdered.
Did police ask you who would want to harm your son?
Yes. It was like, you know, everybody liked Garrett. And, you know, no one ever had a problem with Garrett. And then it's like, oh, there was one person.
Just one?
Just one.
Who was it?
Nick.
Nick Hillary.
Yes.
Tandy says Nick and Garrett didn't get along.
She told me that Garrett had come there and said, I hate Nick. I don't want to live here with him anymore.
2 days after the murder, the police ask Hillary to visit the station. Hillary says police held him against his will all day.
Why do you think there's this depth of fervor to get you?
Because I think I have crossed the line of being a black man, honestly.
You think it's all about race?
It is. I sincerely think it's all about race.
After 3 days of searching the crime scene, authorities can find no evidence linking Nick Hillary to Garrett's murder.
We didn't get any evidence from the items that were tested by the forensic center in Albany.
So no DNA, no hairs, no fibers, right. Really nothing.
They do find 4 sets of fingerprints on this window. None of them belong to Nick Hillary, and it was the only way out for the killer. He appears to have jumped from that window, a daunting leap.
Oh, wow. That is pretty far down.
It's around 20 feet from the windowsill down to the ground.
Police had suspected Hillary from the start. They secretly filmed him pacing the sidelines of a soccer game as he coached, capturing evidence of what they say appears to be a limp.
You didn't jump out a window and injure your ankle trying to escape?
No, I did not. I absolutely have nothing to do with the death of Garrett Phillips.
Nick Hillary is eventually indicted for murder. Prosecutors say a possible motive, perhaps the hope that with her son gone, Tandy might come back to Hillary, or fury at the child who caused the breakup. With 10 jurors already selected for trial, Nick Hillary's defense team suddenly asks for a bench trial, choosing to put his fate in the hands of one man, Judge Felix Katina.
His lawyer smartly felt, we don't want to take the chance of putting this in the hands of a jury.
The many names that have been labeled on this defendant are the innocent man, the wrongfully accused.
5 years after the murder, Nick Hillary's trial begins.
I want you to label him for exactly what he is. The murderer of a helpless 12-year-old boy.
Nick Hillary did not kill Garrett Phillips.
The prosecution's case is based largely on a few moments of security camera video. That video shows Garrett Phillips skateboarding past Nick Hillary's parked car at the Potsdam High School. Moments after Garrett passes, Nick pulls out.
Did you see Garrett skateboard by?
No, I didn't.
Because obviously surveillance tape shows that he did to go home.
Exactly, exactly.
And that's a pretty extraordinary coincidence.
Very much
obviously,
so.
Obviously, given what happened.
Yes.
Hillary claims he went straight home. But watch carefully. Instead of turning right to go straight home, Hillary turns left. Prosecutors say he's following Garrett on his way to commit murder.
Why would you turn left?
When I made a left, my intentions were to get to the office. And I quickly realize I need to make provisions for my daughter at home.
But that's not what his defense attorney argues during the trial. He says Hillary turned left to visit his assistant coach.
The inference you can draw from Nick making the left turn is that he was going to Ian Fairley's house.
This case was primarily based on a surveillance video, potential motive, and his own arguably inconsistent statements. There's no hard evidence, like DNA and fingerprints.
In closing arguments, the defense team repeats the phrase reasonable doubt 25 times.
Proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Reasonable doubt, reasonable doubt.
And questions the motive.
You killed the poor kid with the hope that the mother will come running back into your arms? It makes absolutely no sense.
Finally, just hours ago, Judge Katina with a decision.
It is the judgment of this court that as to the charge of murder in the second degree, as charged in the indictment, the defendant, Oral Nicholas Hillary, is found not guilty.
Nick Hillary acquitted and free to go.
Nick Hillary is an innocent man. This legal team is not oblivious to the fact that there is a family that even after 5 years still grieves.
A final verdict, but a town still divided and still looking for justice for a young boy whose life was cut short. For Nightline, I'm Elizabeth Vargas in Potsdam, New York.
Our thanks to Elizabeth. Catch the first interview with Nick Hillary post-verdict and an inside look at the crime scene. Tune in to 2020 this Friday.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, October 1st, 2016. So I have been told this is our weekly compensatory call-in. Feel free, dial in if you have observations, comments, things you would like to share. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. A few quick comments before we get to callers who would like to chime in. First up, we are listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Once you hit the blog, look in the top right corner. You will see the PayPal button. If you are not comfortable with PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all of the folks who have supported, invested in us, either getting stuff from the wish list or however you have contributed over the years. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of all the generous support the COWS has received. With that, some of the things I did want to make note of. Number one, the image that's attached for folks who saw the event posted on Facebook for this site, for this broadcast, the compensatory call-in. It is from the New York Times Tuesday edition. Now, they have several different editions of the New York Times. Like, they have the local New York version of what the paper looks like. They have the national version, which goes out everywhere else. They have an international version, and they even have a late edition, right, that comes out a little bit later in the day. So it there's a bit of variance. It doesn't look exactly the same, depending on, you know, where you happen to be geographically or even what time in the day you get the paper, the New York Times paper, and I think there are several other papers like that where it might vary depending on, you know, which version you get and all that. The version that I saw in Washington State, the day after the presidential debate, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, it had a big photo of the two candidates from the debate, and then parallel to it, so this is front page above the fold, right, first thing you would see if you look at the paper on Tuesday, candidates, big color picture, and then to the right, looking as though, like, if you were illiterate, you can't read, and you just see what the front page looks like, you would think that the story on the right is connected to the image that you see of Trump and Clinton. That's not the case. The article on the right is not about the debate. The article on the right is about the surge in crime and murders in the U.S. for 2015 being up 10%, I believe it was. I thought that was very significant because if you look at that, at least my brain computer, actually not supposed to be doing metaphors. If you look at that, the way I processed that was, one of the presidential candidates in this image has been saying, We need law and order. There's no respect for police. Crime is out of control. We need more stop and frisk policy. We need a greater police presence to stem the rising tide of crime and lawless niggers being a major contributor to this. Somebody has been saying that, making that, in my view, a critical aspect of their campaign. I thought that was quite interesting to have that front page the day after the election, and I saw it twice. I went to Starbucks that morning, and that was the front page image that they had, and then I saw it again where it was a slightly different image. It was still the debate. It was still Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, but it just was not a photo from the actual debate, but it was still focused on the debate, but it was the same article on the right. And as I said, parallel to it, you would think, if you couldn't read, you would think that the article on the right was something about the debate, something about Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, and what happened at the debate yesterday evening. Fascinating sequencing. There's one more image that I'll say about that, just, I think, at least for me, reinforcing, I think it is significant just seeing the way racists can program you to think. Associations, I frequently have talked about sequencing on the program. None of that is random. None of that is happenstance. All of that is being done in a deliberate manner. Now, I might be, you know, processing it inaccurately, but that's what came to mind for me. A few other things I wanted to touch on. I certainly wanted to hear people's thoughts about the segment that I played at the beginning about the affirmative action plan in Brazil. But one comment that I did want to share, this has nothing to do with the audio clips. I hate social media. I've said that consistently. Particularly, I hate Twitter. Someone messaged me at the beginning of the week. In fact, even before I get to that, I've stated also for years the loathing that I have for these bogus sites that put out these fabricated stories where they just make up anything just to get people to click on it or to fool people into thinking that this is something truthful, and they start sharing it and, you know, getting upset about it or responding to it, and it's actually totally bogus. I think that this aids the system of racism, white supremacy, which is primarily maintained through deception. It makes it very difficult for non-white people to accurately ascertain truth. Beginning of the week, someone sent me a story. It was from a site, the Baltimore Gazette. I had never heard of that. I've checked Baltimore and Maryland news sites. I'd never even heard of this, the Baltimore Gazette. And what they were reporting, allegedly, put that in quotes, what they were saying was that a black mother in Georgia, that she was shot and killed by an enforcement official while she was breastfeeding her child, right? Heinous, you know, incident. And I'm like, wow, I didn't hear about that at all. So I'm, you know, going to see if there's video, you have something. I go to check on this, and immediately the first results that come up, this is totally bogus. The local Georgia outlets, news outlets covered it, as did other sites saying this is not true, that they just made this up. And, you know, like I said, I never even heard of the Baltimore Gazette, and they mentioned that site specifically and saying that they have a pattern of doing this. It seems to be one of those sites where they just, you know, misrepresent and put out misinformation to trick people. Okay, that happened first. Next, someone messaged me, and they said that there was a report about Frank Soledad. I hope I'm saying the name correctly. Frank Soledad. This is not getting a lot of attention. Now, there was no news link included. There was no report of additional information, just a hashtag Frank Soledad. This is not getting a lot of attention. So I clicked the hashtag and just trying to find out what's going on. What is this about? And it is alleging that a New York enforcement official raped a 15-year-old black female. Same thing. I hadn't heard about this. Wow, that's amazing. And we have lots of New York listeners, so I was a little surprised that nobody, you know, had mentioned that or messaged it or brought it up on one of the programs. There were still no news links. There were just people saying, you know, that this happened and this is a disgrace, the whole nine. So I switch, and I'm, you know, now trying to see if I can find some actual news reports about this to share and give out more information. I search, same thing happens. This is the very first links that pop up when I search for this guy's name, that this is not true. So I go to Snopes.com. This is a site where they try to pick out things that are false, being misrepresented online. So I go, I read the article at Snopes, and they're saying that this did not happen in New York. There was an officer, Frank Soledad, if I'm saying the name correctly, who was arrested in South Africa for raping a 15-year-old girl. He was arrested, and, you know, they just went forward with that. They had the link to a South African news site that I actually have seen before. I've read material from there from them before. No reason to think that they put out bogus information. So I respond to the person who shared this hashtag with me originally and just said that this is not being reported correctly, and I sent the link for Snopes. That's it. I didn't, you know, need to do any name calling, didn't do any cursing, anything like that. Just said that this is not being reported correctly, because there were quite a few people online saying that using this guy's name and saying that this, you know, rape took place in New York. The response, and it ended up being multiple people, was, it doesn't matter if this happened in New York or South Africa. Black people, black teen children, black girls are being raped by enforcement officials, and it's not getting attention. It's not being talked about. I am disgusted that you would even respond in that way. I'm disappointed. This is ridiculous. It doesn't matter if it happened in New York, South Africa. This is a total disgrace. And Gus, you just don't care about black females being raped. You don't care about black children being raped. You're just trying to be concerned. And Snopes is not even a reputable news site. All right. I took all of that, and my response, I actually had no response other than to begin using my block button on social media. My only response is, if you are not concerned, and I want to make sure I get it in for the record, no one stepped forward to say I was incorrect. No one stepped forward to say that this did happen in New York. You, Gus, don't know what you're talking about. You're retarded, or you went to the wrong site. No one stepped forward to say that. It was just, it doesn't matter where it happened at. This is happening, and you are supporting rape culture. I'm suggesting, they didn't use these exact words, but this is what was suggested with the commentary. You're supporting rape culture. You are a misogynist, sexist, patriarch, and you don't care about black females. My only response, I use my block button, and I would tell anyone, if that's the conclusion that you come to, please unfriend me, unfollow me, and do not ever listen to this program again, and make sure you do not ever contact me again. Also, if you don't care about accurate information, it doesn't matter. Sandra Bland was stabbed to death in Hawaii earlier this year by three white men. It doesn't matter whether it happened in Hawaii or Texas. If that's your assessment, because multiple people did say that, doesn't matter if it happened in South Africa, New York, whatever. If that's your assessment, if that's your way of doing business, cool and the gang. Make sure you do not ever contact me again for any reason. That is totally opposite of the way that I try to go about doing business. I have said on this program for the duration of this year, strive for accuracy. We are in a system where it is already so difficult to get accurate, truthful information, where you have racists who are dedicated to lying and putting out false information. That is one thing that would make a huge, we would make a lot of progress against white supremacy in just getting accurate information. Anytime that we're talking about racism, I've said this for years, so many people have died just talking about racism. So frequently, black people, non-white people, just talking about racism end up having their views distorted, lie about what they said or what they wrote, particularly when you have non-white people being victimized. People start lying about what they did or what they said. This happens all the time. One of the things that we can do, just make sure we put out accurate information. Really, in my opinion, if you really care about someone who is a victim of rape, a victim of racism, a victim of any crime, any non-white person who has been mistreated, I would think you would want accurate information being reported so that people will not be confused when they go to research this incident, if they want to follow it and see what happens with the trial, if they want to keep tabs on this and share it with other people. I would think you would want accurate information reported. Apparently, everyone, that's not how they view things. No problem. If you're not concerned about correct information, just make sure you do not contact Gus for anything. And just adding an addendum to all of this, The News 24 report, where they mentioned this rape that took place in South Africa, not New York, the report, cops behind bars, cop singular, behind bars after allegedly raping girl at police station. The bail application of a policeman accused of raping a 15-year-old girl at the Montague police station was postponed in the local magistrate's court on Wednesday. The warrant officer's lawyer asked the matter to be postponed to October 10 as they were still following up on certain aspects of the case. The 47-year-old officer is accused of raping the girl on August 30th after she was taken to the police station to cool down following an altercation with her parents at home. The Independent Police Investigative Directorate is investigating the matter. The key word that you did not hear in this report, and it is on other South African news sites about this rape, black. It would seem to me folks have even jumped to a conclusion, made an assumption that this was a 15-year-old black girl. They didn't list the racial classification of the alleged rapist or the victim. Not every 15-year-old in South Africa is black. This could have been a white female. This could have been a colored, as the term they use in South Africa, a colored 15-year-old. Just pointing that out. And again, if you don't care, cool in the gang, just make sure you do not contact Gus about anything. And I will end all of this with what I have said for almost a decade. If you like the cows, so what? If you do not like the cows, so what? Replace white supremacy with justice, and I will continue to say, strive for accuracy. That alone works against racism, white supremacy, and I forgot to say last week, it was stated that the first 14 presidents of the United States were slave owners. That also is not true. You can go and look for yourself. One of the first five was not a slave owner. Strive for accuracy. The folks that dialed in, if you have commentary you would like to share, the first set of people who have a hand up, line is open. I didn't really mention that because I have already come to a conclusion in terms of my assessment of all of that, accuracy being important. If you do not agree, that's fine. If you have anything to say about all that, that is cool in the gang, but this is not anything that is up for debate or discussion. I've made my conclusion. If you, you know, disagree, as I said, feel free, unfollow, unfriend, and, you know, discontinue your association with the cows. And if we could not use metaphors, that would be grand. I found that also frequently we are making false equivalents and comparing things that are not equal. If we could not use metaphors and be explicit, straightforward about what it is that we're trying to say, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about that as we go. The first set of folks who dialed in with a hand up, line, your line is open. I will nab others as we just go down the line.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, guests, and the rest of the callers. So, I recently watched the debate, and I found it to kind of be a type of nonsense because it's not really helping with anything. Well, it kind of helped to express who the candidates are, really, and it was just going back and forth just about problems just based on America, and especially Trump. He expressed the most nonsense, especially with his rant about Mexico and how we need to make America great again. And I also noticed that when the host was asking Trump the question specifically, he refused to answer them directly. He would always go back to the topic, we need to make America great again. And I found that to be very interesting as to say that he doesn't want to give us the answers. I'm going to say that it's not because he doesn't know, because he should know if he's running for president. But he's just trying to get to the point that he wants to make America great again, and we already knew that from the start. So I found that kind of interesting. But other than that, yeah, that's all I wanted to share. Thank you for taking my call.
Did you all discuss the debate at the – I don't know if your group met. You talked to us before about your black student group at your school. Did you all discuss the debate, or did you all even meet this week?
We haven't discussed the debate yet, but we should be discussing it after the second one, which is on the 9th. But, yeah.
Fascinating. Keep us abreast. I'd be interested to hear what some of your young peers have to say about all this. Other folks who dialed in, do you all have commentary? Other folks who, the first set of folks who dialed in with the hand ups, you all have commentary? Line should be open. People are just hanging out and breathing on the phone. Fascinating. Let's see, nab some of the other folks who have a hand up.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I think I can't remember the name of that. I think the player is from the University of Nebraska, and it was very interesting how he was he made that statement. It was kind of codified because, like, I remember watching the video, and he said, you know, this is pretty much all I'm going to say on this. And, you know, they wanted to keep asking him about the, I guess, the statement he made and how, like, well, I know you've done programs on this before about, you know, the taunting and the racist suspects practicing racism at the games as fans for the opposing team. I think that's how he phrased it, the opposing teams behind him, or the, you know, the opposing fans behind him. And, you know, it really takes a lot of courage to point that out and really direct the attention towards racism, because I believe a lot of us are beginning to think that this is really all connected. We just need a lot more clarity and understanding, I think. And I think it was the clip about the mayor. I guess they may have had a forum or something about, I guess, people wanting him to step down. And I'm under the understanding that I guess he doesn't want to. And I think from the article that I remember seeing, I guess he was saying something about it was a witch hunt, if that's the same guy. And like I think that term that's used is called conflation, that they were saying, oh, he was also talking about women and you know, Jews and stuff like that, and using a whole bunch of other terms to get it away from racism. And, you know, it's very interesting how they can really deviate from where the focus should be. And I also seen a story, I think it was in Tennessee, and it was very interesting how it happened, because I think it was a Black Lives Matter protest. There was some protesters. And it was this suspected race soldier. He had on a gorilla mask with some bananas tied in a rope. So, you know, he had planned this out, apparently, because, you know, usually they like to be anonymous online and, you know, like to stay hidden and deceitful and deceptive. And, you know, the Black male, he had it on camera. And the guy was saying, oh, you know, we're here for you, you know. And the guy, he kept saying, you know, what are you doing here? What are you trying to do? And, you know, he still had on this gorilla mask. And apparently, I think why it ended up happening this way, the police officer ended up, I guess, charging him with the crime. And the crime they labeled, the term they used was civil rights intimidation. Like, I never even heard of that right there. So, I haven't even gotten a chance to look it up. I can't remember what the guy's name was, but he, you know, he went out there with this bag that had the Confederate flag on it and a banana and, you know, a rope, I guess, to represent a noose and lynching. And his face was on the camera. Like, they made him take off the gorilla mask. So I think what that was, that it was like, hey, you know, that's a little too blatant, you know. You got a little unrefined, you know, like you're supposed to be very hidden and skillful. That was an unskillful act, I think. They came to the conclusion of that, so they had to, you know, extract him from the premises. And, yeah, he got charged with civil rights intimidation. I'm like, what in the world is that? the guy ended up saying that I wanted to provoke the protesters. That's what he said. Like, I wanted to provoke them. So, you know, nobody ended up physically attacking him or anything. But it just goes to show you, like, how that didn't really make the news. And I guarantee you that is going on, like, all the time in all areas of activity. So I got to try and find the name of that person. And I'll send you the information on that. And that's all I have for now. Thank you.
His name is Tristan John Redke. This was mentioned when we had Kelly Freeman, the suspected race soldier. She was on the program, I guess, Wednesday of this week. She was in Tennessee. She mentioned this incident, so we read about the report during the broadcast. But, yeah, that's his name. They have a photograph. Apparently he was a student at East Tennessee State, but they are saying in this report that he is no longer enrolled, whatever that means. But, yeah, that was the charge. I've never heard of that charge either, civil rights intimidation. I have no idea what that means, and it would seem that a whole lot of people are guilty of what they're calling civil rights intimidation, if that is, you know, an authentic charge.
Yes, sir. Thanks for putting that name out there, because I couldn't remember what it was. And I haven't seen that many examples of them getting caught in the act like that on camera. And, you know, I guess having the law enforcement, I guess, somewhat punishing them, even though I don't think it was a solid punishment. I think he'll still, you know, eventually be able to go and apply somewhere else and get help from, you know, the team. So, yeah, thanks for that information.
Absolutely. This would be another one of those cases. Racists, they do not get fired. They get transferred. I'm sure he'll be able to just go to another academic institution and, you know, continue on, even take his gorilla mask and bananas with him to continue his pursuit of higher education. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you are just lollygagging, the people that have dialed in with a hand up and are not commenting, we can still hear you, like, breathing on the phone and background noise. So if you could use your mute button if you are just hanging out, if you have no comments at this time, that would be grand, just to keep down the background noise and distortion. That would be super appreciated. Thank you kindly.
No comment at this time. Maybe in a few minutes. Sorry about that.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Me too. No comment at this time.
Thank you kindly. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up.
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, greetings to you guys. This is Ross. Yeah, I'm going to touch on a couple of these clips and just a couple other things, too. I thought that the clip that you played in the beginning, I didn't hear the clip about affirmative action in Brazil, so I can't really comment on that. Excuse me. I didn't hear that at all, so I don't know how to comment on it since I didn't hear it. But the one that you played of the football player, the college football player who was discussing all of the race antics that was taking place at different games and just his own experiences and the experiences of two of his other players that he plays with on his team. I just think that all of these incidences really brings the need for a nationwide boycott, of all sporting events by black people. I just think that no black people should show up for any sporting events whatsoever. And that would maybe make these white people think a little bit more, because they'll start losing a lot of money, especially when it comes to the college games and professional sports. I think if just all black people just said, we're not going to play for any of you racist terrorists, and we're not going to play for you on TV, we're not playing for you at all until you, you know, replace the system with a system of justice, I think that would have the biggest impact. But it does feel good to see all these people coming forward, both young and adult players coming forward and speaking out about these things. So hopefully it'll facilitate more of the same, I would say. I thought about the Black Wall Street clip. Both the reporter and the interviewee were referring to the event as a race riot. I hate that term. It's just aggravating because it's not accurate. What it really was a racist massacre by white people of black people, and that's really what it should be referred to, or something similar, in my opinion. I think that really just distorts the reality of what actually happened and gives the false impression that that there were equal combatants who basically destroyed property and you know, burned down a city, when that couldn't be nothing could be further from the truth, in the sense that it was just a complete wholesale massacre of black people, men, women, and children, elderly, it didn't matter. They were just gunning them down. And I thought the section where they discussed white people bringing children, young children, the type of children that they'll take out at 6 and 7 years old on hunting expeditions to shoot at deer. I mean, these were young children basically brought to this event and given full sanction to murder black people. Is proof to me that all white people are racist, no matter how old they are. Like one of the previous guests said that she was racist in the womb. That is white people, and I think that this was a great example of that, because I don't understand how a child whose mind has not fully developed yet, because they're young, to be brought to an event like that and watch such wholesale destruction of human life and not be adversely affected by that, unless that is in their genetic code to be exactly what they are, which is psychotic racist terrorists. I sent you a news article not too long ago discussing the Jawara tribe in the Andaman Islands and the fact that now they're at risk of going extinct ever since they allowed tourism, which really means allowing white people to come into the island and utilize it as a tourism destination. They've now utilized alcohol and tobacco to further destroy the culture and the lives of these people, and now they're on the verge of extinction. So wherever white people go, death is not too far behind. And then not too long ago as well, another incident of black murder came out by police, and it was a dash cam video showing police attempting to run over a mentally ill man before jumping out of the vehicle and shooting him 14 times and killing him. And the police officers actually heard saying on the video, in the audio segment, saying he's going to hit him, and his partner saying, do it, basically go for it, go for it. So they're egging each other on about basically hitting this man with their vehicle to try and kill him. And then after that, they leap out of the car and basically shoot him 14 times. When it was said by numerous people that this man was mentally ill, the people who called 911 because they said he had a knife in his hand, and somebody, I don't know who said it, but they said that he also had a gun, which the police never found. It turned out that they said that he had a four-inch knife in his hand, and he was just behaving erratically in public. And it just goes along with the other clips you were playing in regards to the mentally ill person who was shot and killed. I think it was in Canada. So, I mean, this is just, like, just ridiculous, the kind of stuff that's going on and that's, you know, allowed to take place in this system. And there's a lot of work to be done, but I think if we all start to really understand what it means to be white and how they function and the fact that they are all terroristic, they are all racist, you just might have an encounter that's less racist than another one, but they're all racist. And that's all I have to say. Thank you for taking my call, and I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that. Other folks who dialed in, who have a hand up, if you had commentary you wanted to share, you should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. I'm just reminded of the protests of the football, non-white black male football players on the college, collegiate, and professional level. It reminds me of 50 years ago or so, when non-white black males were being recruited at a lot of these Division I colleges, especially the ones in the southern part of the Northwest Hemisphere. And it just shows me that there's no change in white people and their behavior. Their lives are in danger. It's similar to what it was back 50, 60 years ago, when that was going on. I can recall there was an excellent documentary I forgot the title of it, but it was basically what the documentary was about, was the first non-white black males to quote unquote integrate some of the large Southern Division I colleges, such as Auburn University, Alabama, several more that I can't recall, and they were given their testimonies. Is everything all right?
Yes, sir. Just some of the folks using their mute button, so it's echoing.
Oh, okay. I could almost feel the hostility for those few courageous non-white black young people for what they're, because it's not like they're getting any type of monetary or if the idea, the lie is that they're seeking for attention. Well, I can find a better way to seek for attention instead of that type of tremendously hostile environment, let alone not just at the stadium, but as you're leaving the locker room or the stadium, walking around campus as a student, it's all around. And as far as professional, basically the same thing. You do go places other than just the football field, and how that actually follows that person or those individuals around. So my thought just came to my mind about it, on the sacrifices that they actually are making in doing what they're doing. Other than that, I did speak again with the non-white black male that's on the team he admitted he had a long history. He has a long history of being ridiculed for being heavily melanated, which a lot of us know that it actually is a asset as opposed to a detriment. I expressed that to him. I gave an example of what non-white black male Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas went through. Not so much about some of the things that I would put up to being VGQ as far as some of the reported decisions that he's made. That wasn't relevant to the conversation. But he is a victim of racist white supremacy, and part of the mental anguish with this person of being a victim was he was chastised. I did hear on the show that he was chastised by other people, probably some of them non-white black people, because it still happens today. And I mentioned that to him, and I stated to him also that, be aware that is something that is unfortunately, that is a reaction that people do that's negative, but never ever let anybody pull you off focus for the things that you are here for. And as I mentioned to everybody, this young person is very talented. He has mastered the saxophone, probably some other instruments that I don't even know about. He's a straight A student. He's a straight A student in school, and with his athletic ability, he also is good enough to earn a scholarship as far as athletic wise. He can also earn a scholarship academically. And this is the type of interaction that I would have wanted when I was his age with a coach. So that's why I try to do it with the young people that I come in contact with. I don't worry about from the standpoint of who it gets to, you know, as far as they're concerned. The only thing they can do is tell me to leave. That's it. And it's too much of an advantage to be around for me to only talk about football. And the football is the easy part, actually. And what I get from a response from the conversations is they, you know, these young people truly understand on where I'm coming from. And so that's basically my report, and thank everybody for listening.
Appreciate that. Your volume is low. If you could speak up, that would be helpful.
Yes, may I be better?
That is better.
Yes, sir. Yes, my name is Lamine, first-time caller. I've been listening for over a year now. I really appreciate the call in. One of the items that stuck out to me on the news clips was the Keith Lamont Scott speaking about him possibly smoking weed, or the officer saying he was smoking weed in the car. It really kind of made me think a lot about what Dr. Kamel Cambon and Dr. Welsing, their thoughts on recreational drugs, specifically marijuana, non-black people or non-whites, and taking those type of drugs, you know, like smoking reefer during this time or not being sober is putting us in the crosshairs of these terrorists. We see that white terror continues, and they use any excuse to come after us. It really made me think about sobriety as a non-white black male, specifically around white people, and how they respond to that. And it's almost, you could see the level of tacky explanation that was given by the reporter when they were, I believe, might have been Michelle Martin or the interviewer, was interviewing this gentleman, and he was almost excusing, he sounded like a white male, but it's almost like excusing or questioning whether it was an appropriate action to take on behalf of the officer. The system always supports itself, continually to reinforce the thought that has been made several times that white terror, the good white people are non-existent. Just based on the evidence that we have, they will continue to perpetuate the system. And that is just evidenced by these news reports that we're reading about their consistent behavior, which is not 1865, not 1921, it's 2016. As another thought on the massacre, which I appreciate the brother calling and what it is that occurred in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I was born in Oklahoma and believe I knew a lot about the history. I'm not from that time period. I mean, of course, I'm in my 30s, but I do not recall ever being told about what happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And similar to, I believe the clip with Neely Fuller at the beginning, I was only a few miles from Tulsa. I mean, maybe 100 miles or so from there, but like we never knew anything about that. Never did I read or hear about it. Knowing everything about Texas history, Oklahoma history, all the other white history, and we can see how it was minimized and almost made non-existent. And that is just, again, a continued pattern. And it's funny, she was talking about how a woman made a comment on how the children were taken out there and how some of their relatives, maybe the surviving relatives of the children of the people who were there are still alive. So we have this image of this being something way in the past, but it's still with us. I mean, you could imagine if your neighbor's father was shooting black people and where that kind of mindset comes from. But it's extremely important for us to stay on task. It's great for us to hear these reports. And just one last comment regarding the people who are sometimes we're sending out uncorroborated stories, and the reaction that was given to the host when he responded saying, hey, this is not correct, and you don't want to be accurate. The victims have this, where we're looking for this information, and because we're getting it from all these different sources, yeah, I believe the media is definitely assisting white supremacy, getting black people, specifically via social media, to practice this pseudo-revolutionary activity, which is getting a lot of us non-white people deeper into their system, using their tools to build up their empires. And consistently, there are arguments that happen between non-white people on these social media platforms, which is totally not constructive, non-constructive behavior, as opposed to trying to find a solution to this problem of racism, white supremacy. And it's just further proof that we have to constantly stay on guard, because the level of deception we're dealing with is so high, and we definitely need to work with other victims. I'll take my call offline. Thank you. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. I agree with you, Gus. I mean, it does make sense to be accurate. I try to be accurate. And I've been corrected sometimes by you, and if I was wrong, I was wrong. I mean, I don't see why someone would go on a rant. White people are not practicing accuracy, and we need to be accurate. We need to stay on top of them. So, and especially to say something happened in New York City, and it happened all the way in South Africa, two totally different forms of white supremacy. I mean, and not to care about that. We live here. I mean, so either way, Brazil, you know, Brazil has a complicated system. I think the U.S. has the best system of racial classification in the world with the one-drop rule. That way it's no, it's pretty much no getting around it. You're either white or you're not. You know, it's pretty simple, but... Man, I wonder if these racial tests have to do with the coup de grace they had earlier this year when they removed the black woman president, Dilma Rousseff, and replaced her with the white man, Michael Temer. I wonder if that has anything to do with these racial classification to get a government job now. The school terrorism, I've been tracking it since August when school started, and every week it gets worse. With the protest of the national anthem, it's really going, it's really looking quite interesting. I'm hoping that these people, the black people on the campuses, are waking up and becoming less confused as these events continue, and I hope they're following the trends, because, I mean, every day it's three or four stories on terrorism of some type on these school campuses. And even this week, it was a white girl who posted on, I think, Snapchat, a picture of her in blackface, saying she's trying to fit in at the HBCU that she attends for free because she's white. It just, they just continue their ignorant behavior. I think it's... These black kids on campus need to start figuring out that this is not ignorance. This is deliberate. Your good friend Bill Mayer, Gus, he's such a racist and he's such a liberal pundit. You know, no one lies more than Trump, you know. And that's truly true. You know, he does lie a lot, but he hasn't lied about his racist agenda at all. He has been pretty upfront. He wants to build the wall, keep out the Mexicans. He wants to implement stop and frisk again. We could walk out our houses and get shot in the head. He's pretty much keeping it the way he always has, which I respect more than Mrs. Clinton, who has lied under oath. You know, she's bleached phones and destroyed stuff with hammers and received 30,000 emails illegally and lied to Congress and lied before grand juries and then turned around and blamed it all on Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. I mean, it gets no worse than her. I mean, she's just a more way, way, way more refined racist. And I like Kaepernick's statement. They both racist. I mean, either way you cut it, you know, it just depends on how you want to be dominated, this way or that way. You know, the situation in North Carolina, you know, I just use logic. You know, cops are going to serve a warrant. They're driving past the man they see rolling a blunt or a joint, and he's holding a gun. And I don't see how that could happen unless you got three hands. So instead of going to serve a court-issue warrant, they double back to stop this man they saw rolling a blunt and holding a gun. And I just don't think that's logical. The narrative, though, however, in the media has shifted from a black man being shot by police to claims he had a gun, which could have potentially been a book, to now a black drug addict, weed head, has a gun, and now he's been shot by the police. Whereas the narrative should be, and if this is competent media and people really doing journalism, is in the crime scene photos, where did that gun come from? Because it's not on none of the videos. And no one's talking about that, so it just shows that they're not really serious about solving this case. It's just white people doing what they do. The clip you played about poverty and law enforcement, you know, I'm not sure if it's that complicated with all the numbers, but if you just look at two cities, big cities, with the same exact population almost to a T, Philly and Phoenix, and both have 1.5 million people. Philly, I think, might have 20,000 or so more, but it's pretty much the same thing. Phoenix has 93,000 black people, 6.5% of their population. Philly has 670,000 black people, 44.3% of their population. Phoenix has 4,000 cops and law enforcement personnel. Philly almost doubles that. They have 7,500 law enforcement personnel and cops. Phoenix averages 20 cops per 10,000 people. So Phoenix averages 20 cops per 10,000 people, and Philly averages 43 cops per 10,000 people. So it's obvious that if you're in a city with more black people, you're going to have more cops. It's just I went all down the board. It's the same thing everywhere. And the place with the most black people here in New York, about 3,000, 3 million black people, 2.5 million or so. And we have almost 60,000 law enforcement personnel. So it pretty much shows. However, what struck me as I was listening to the clip and looking at the numbers, Phoenix has more property crime, burglary, larceny, double the motor theft of Philly. But yet they have almost half the law enforcement personnel because it's all white people. Just the last little piece I wanted to add in. This week, white people announced that they're going to Mars. They could leave as early as 2018 and be landing there in 2024. They plan on having 1 million people on Mars in the next decade. And this is all for $10 billion a person. So we pretty much know who they're eliminating, pretty much everybody. So same week, NASA lands the Rosetta spaceship on a comet. This is the first time ever. They were very proud, standing up, cheering in the room. Now, the Rosetta is an Egyptian stone. It's also called the Shabaka stone. It's pretty much the proof that the Egyptians created the phonetic languages, the hieroglyphics, and the Semitic languages. It's pretty much like a sign written in English, Spanish, and French, you know, all saying the same thing, but written in the three different languages, 10,000 years old. Either way, this comet, where it lands at, is called Mayat, which is the Egyptian goddess. pretty much known for justice. White people have painted her white, and they put her in front of all the courthouses, holding the two scales. She's, you know, Lady Justice. But metaphysically, you know, when the ISIS thing happened, you know, I said this is going to be a war against black women, the black goddess ISIS. And here they have this whole crash landing on my yacht. So I couldn't think that this whole attack on black women is going to increase and pick up. I think that by this, the funny thing about this space probe is this camera's name is Osiris, who is, of course, the black god. So with this black god crash landing on my yacht, I expect for them to have a pickup in the violence from towards the black women being in the media shown by black men doing it, sort of like Ray Rice. And at the same time, you had a couple of other incidents with black men attacking black women, including one incident where I think at the same time Solange was attacking Jay-Z and his big bodyguard grabbed her. It was just, you know, just the thing they were able to spin it to looking like it's coming from the black man. So I just thought that was interesting, and I'll meet my line thinking.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Awesome, awesome. This is Kent Steele from Chicago. I just want to say the last report that we heard from Thomas, very eye-opening, and I'm kind of blown away by some of that information. I just wanted to report on a few things that I have noticed this week that have come into media attention. And there was a report of a student at a local university infiltrating a Black Lives Matter demonstration while wearing the gorilla mask and having the bananas out. And I don't know if you guys have been paying attention to younger suspected white supremacists here in the United States, but one of the things that have become very popular amongst them is a meme, referencing Harambee the gorilla, who was recently killed this summer in the Cincinnati, Ohio Zoo. And that whole situation, from the moment that it hit the news, I believe has been used as kind of an allegory for the way that we are, or this society is treating black people. And the thing about this meme that is particularly insidious is because I think it's specifically to mock black death, period. The way that this meme is kind of permeated through the culture and the way that it's been manifested amongst 20-something white males in particular is very troubling to me, and it suggests to me that this is specifically about making fun of dead black people. If you even see some of the brands that are associated with hip-hop, listening white males. They even have shirts that are of airbrushed memorials to Harambee, and they look just like the kind of memorials that you would see for dead black people or dead non-white people in urban areas. Again, very troubling. The news media has kind of picked up on the use of these memes by suspected white supremacists. And they picked up on the one named Pepe the Frog. And I think the announcement was by the suspected white supremacist-dominated Anti-Defamation League. They went ahead and released a statement saying that Pepe the Frog is somehow a racist meme, and it's directed toward people that they identify as Jewish. And the problem, or I don't have a problem with this identification. I think it's a good thing, but they are completely missing the whole Harambee connection. And the reason why they're using these memes to kind of communicate their white supremacist leanings is so that they can go ahead and ridicule those people who point out the fact that, hey, you are practicing white supremacy by mentioning these memes and the way that you're using these memes. The way that it goes is you will point it out, and or someone will point it out, and they will ask, well, how is this racist? And I've come to the conclusion that when more than three suspected white supremacists are asking how something is racist, you can guarantee that they're definitely practicing racism in their use of that meme or that image. And this kind of comes in a long history of racist memes. And I'm aware of these racist memes because I have a long history of being a black person on the internet, or being unapologetically black, or being openly black. I never really hid behind avatars or handles that kind of obscured my the fact that I am a non-white person. So some of the memes that I've noticed in the past that they've used are a meme called Charging My Laser, where they would have some sort of black dot. They would have black eyes, red lips, and would have, I guess, an aurora, a light coming out of that person's mouth. And I guess it was a reference to some sort of Japanese programming. This was related to a meme that they called Shoot de Whoop, I think is a reference to it. So they would just have that kind of Charging My Laser ridiculousness on screen. They would say the caption Shoot de Whoop, and you know, that was how they communicated you know, harming non-white people amongst themselves. And then finally, if you go back further, far enough, there is a meme that they called Bix Nude, which is a reference to a phrase in the original, one of the original racist memologists on the internet, a man by the name of A. Wyatt Mann, who made a whole bunch of racist comics. Anyway, so the word Bix Nude is kind of, I guess, white supremacist interpretation of what black people say, and it's kind of a gibberish phrase, but it's what they've used to kind of identify non-white people talking, I guess. And so they use these memes throughout conversation on the internet to elude censors, to aggravate non-white people, and to make non-white people look ridiculous when they point out that they're operating and they're coordinating using of these memes. So just be on the lookout for that. I suggest reporting that stuff whenever you see it. I report it whenever I see it on Facebook. I block people that use this these sort of phrases, and just be aware of what these people are saying, because you know, it starts out as Shoot the Whoop or Charging My Laser, and then the next thing you know, they're showing up to a demonstration with bananas, and then after that, you know, they're so bold that they're showing up with bullets. So that's something that I think needs to be noted by non-white people, and not just people who identify themselves as Jewish, you know, operating in the ADL. Another thing that I wanted to mention is the debate. Both Hillary and Donald were on stage debating. They had a mini black community debate. And the thing that struck me as noteworthy about this debate was that neither one of these candidates said anything about increasing black business, increasing the number of black people in positions of power. No mention of eliminating the wage gap between blacks and whites. No mention of increasing black access to education. If you recall, Chicago, there's been a number of school closings, and you know, there's been very little talk about how to fill that gap. There's been no there's been no mention of increasing access to clean water, which is very sad that we have to have that as an issue for non-white people in the United States, but no mention of that. The only thing that they talked about was so-called law and order, on Donald's side and taking away gun rights on Hillary's side. So they basically just want to police us harder and take away our means of defending ourselves, which leads me to suggest or to that it just leads me to think that I personally think that they're on their final solution strategy, and all of the protests that you see that are taking place, they're coming to a head, and they're preparing for whoever takes over next is going to be charged with the responsibility of dispersing all of these protests. I think that they are going to increase the amount of violence that you see against non-white people. And I think that precursors of this violence can be seen here in Chicago. I think that we've had a number of the shootings that have taken place this week have all a number of them have taken place on the roadways. So it seems like they're focusing on expressways. It seems like they're focusing on shooting at cars. I believe there was two killings that took place on the expressway. There was another shooting of a bus driver here in Chicago. And then there was a fourth killing of a teenager in a car in the back of the Yards neighborhood. And then finally, just to kind of put this all into context, I saw that they released a trailer for a documentary that they're coming out with called Do Not Resist, which appears to be a justification for the militarization of police. If you have an opportunity, look up the trailer of Do Not Resist. It is all about basically the police force acting as a domestic military wing that is designed to thwart, quickly they'll mention ISIS, and then boom, in the trailer you'll see that they're talking about black people. They're talking about quote-unquote Ferguson. So I think all of this is all in the context of what we've seen in the debates and what you're seeing on the streets. They're all in context. I think it's all towards a final solution type situation where they're going to take out a large number of black people, and I believe it's going to take place at one of these protests. So be careful at these protests, and please pay attention to what's happening and what's going on. Thank you so much. I will go ahead and mute my line at this time.
Hi, ma'am, I'm here.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Good evening to guest the host and to the callers. Hope, you know, you're doing reasonably well on the plantation. Anyway, just a couple of things. I want to thank you for addressing the issue about some of the stories that we're getting, because I remember the story with the Baltimore Gazette, and I think I even put it up on my page. And then later on, I went to look up the Baltimore Gazette and realized that, oh, my God, this really isn't a true story. When I try to find them out, if I do that, I do try to take them down and apologize for them. But I just really do want to thank you for that, because we do need to be careful. And actually, with some of the stuff that's going on, I hear whoever is putting that story out, we really need to look up the website first, you know, before, you know, we want to, you know, before people want to post those stories or either share them on their page or send them to a friend, you know, or something like that. But I want to thank you for addressing that, and I like what you said. When here it is, you're telling somebody this is not a true story, and then people coming back, you know, in this case, women, oh, you know, you're not supporting women, this, that, this, that. And I'm saying all that to say, as I'm on Facebook and I'm looking at that thing, I'm just to the point that, and I don't want to get to anti-blackness because I love my people, but I just think I need to say this. I'm just getting to the point that I'm looking at. There are just some black people who just want to complain all the time. You know, you can't say anything about black women without them flying off the handle. And I know sometimes I get into some of these conversations, and I am the type of black woman. I get it. I mean, I get what's going on out here, you know, with us. I mean, I don't get it all, but I get some of it. But I also, too, I can get on some of these things, and, you know, it's, especially if you have a black men and black women, and it's just, you have black women, just black men, black men, black men. And I'm like, no, it's not all just black men. There are black women doing things also. So, I mean, I get that, and they come back at you, and, I mean, they come back, and they come back hard. I mean, they really do. But, you know, like you said, you know, if you don't like it, you can unfriend me. You can do it. You can unfriend me. You'll be blocked, what have you, because it just gets so crazy. And so you have stories out here. And then I saw a Facebook story that said that, especially with the environment that we're in now, you have to be careful because they said now you got people making up stories, and particularly stories, putting them on sites where black people will look at to get us all the stats, and then they sit back laughing while we're putting these stories out that are bogus. And I have no doubt that white people do that stuff. I have no doubt a lot of the things that we see going on with Facebook, the friend requests, even some of these crazy stories, some of this hacking that's going on, is being done by Facebook. I just think it's a lot of it and too much to be going on. And that's to say that people can do it. But I do think that Facebook has a lot to do with what is going on to either keep confusion among, you know, people in generally, then, you know, particularly black people with us specifically. So I just, you know, really do want to thank you for addressing that, because it appears to me like it's getting worse. And if we're not careful, because I know, like, TMZ, there's a site called TMZ Hip Hop, which, if I'm not mistaken, I know there's TMZ, but I think the TMZ Hip Hop site is just like a bogus site. And, you know, needless to say, everything that comes up on that is dealing with black people. But, so, you know, thanks for dealing with that. Be clear with Bill Maher. I mean, it's just unnecessary. I mean, you know, he just lets himself, I mean, just, you know, what he would say about Kaepernick, all because of, you know, I guess what he said about Hillary Clinton. You know, it's just like, well, he's not lying about neither Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. But I just don't even get into Bill Maher anymore, you know. And if you have people sitting up there on that stage with him and he's saying things like that and nobody's checking him, that to me is very troublesome. As for the debate, I did not watch it. I never, ever do watch the debate. But, you know, I go on Facebook and I read the comments of people. And so, you know, I can see how it is. So I'm not shocked at all by, you know, somebody earlier spoke about we really should be concerned about the lack of things that they're not talking about. Everything seems to be so personal, but, you know, it's just things that they're not talking about. And I know one issue that I would like to hear somebody address is, and I'll say this now, and I'll mute myself after this, is the Fourth Amendment. Now, this is October, August, maybe end of July. The Supreme Court handed down, I think I mentioned this before, handed down a decision. It had something to do with a guy who came out of a house. The police said the house was a known drug house. They stopped the man, and I think they, you know, stopped him, questioned him. They fell out of the search in his car, find some marijuana. They take him in, arrest him. So I guess the case goes to trial, and I think his attorney was basically saying that you can't use the marijuana because, you know, you didn't have reasonable cause to believe that, blah, blah, blah. Well, anyway, somehow this case makes it all the way to the Supreme Court. And basically the Supreme Court guts the Fourth Amendment by basically saying that, you know, hey, you know, if you're standing on the street corner, the police walk up to you and ask for your name and stuff, you need to produce your stuff. And if they run you through and find, like, you got a warrant out, so, like, they do can be arrested. And I remember Justice Sonia Sotomayor, she wrote the dissent, and she's just like, this, you know, no, this is not good. And then she basically said the way it would play out on the streets is that brown people and black people would just basically bear the brunt of this. I can't help but think when we're looking at what's going on out here with the killings of unarmed black men. I understand North Carolina is a concealed carry state. Not that the guy had a gun, because I don't believe that he did. But I know here in Ohio, it's a concealed carry state, and I know three black males have been killed. And so I felt like to say that nobody even seems to be even asking the question, how does the meat, if you will, of that amendment, does anybody plan to restore it, or does anybody plan to restore it? Is it just that now you have, 24, 25 amendments, however many amendments the Constitution has, but the Fourth Amendment is just there. It doesn't carry any weight. So I think there are very significant issues that even just through this whole campaign are not being addressed. I would say this, and I will mute myself. Where I live at, there are a lot of houses. I mean, there are houses that I come down the street, and they have all these Trump signs in them. And so, you know, I think last week we were saying this, like, I kind of agree, you know, if there's got to be, just let the out-and-out racist be elected, who I think that we would venture to say that's Donald Trump. Not that we're not saying that Hillary Clinton is the racist, but when I look at those signs, I'm just like, I hope Trump loses, because it's like all these old white men. And I was driving down the street today, and I almost could hear white men say, who if Trump was elected? We're going to show these niggers. We're going to show these niggers. And then on the other side, I almost hear that if Hillary is elected, we're going to get these niggers. We're going to get these niggers because, you know, they didn't, you know, they voted for Hillary. And so it's just a mess. It's just a straight out mess. So thank you. I'll mute myself. Thank you.
Anybody that has not had an opportunity to share, your line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard?
Good evening, Gus.
We'll get to our female caller.
Let the lady go. Yeah, go ahead.
Right on.
Good evening, Gus and audience. This is Jersey Girl calling from New Jersey. I haven't been on the line, but I do get your podcast, and I listen. I did get an opportunity to listen to the debate on Monday, and let me tell you, I was totally appalled. I mean, Donald Trump did Hillary Clinton. I mean, what is this world coming to? I mean, him saying, you should ask Sean Hannity. You should ask Sean Hannity. Who is Sean Hannity to ask the question to? I mean, like, he wrote the book on words or something. And the fact, here I am, I'm on the East Coast, I'm in New Jersey, and I know the brother from New York was appalled at the fact that he talked about law and order and mentioning Giuliani and bringing back stop and frisk and then saying, oh no, that's not on. I mean, the guy was the. I mean, people have to understand, I think one thing Clinton just stressed, people are really looking at us, I mean, all around the country, looking at this, that phone. I was saying to myself, what is the world thinking about us looking at these two people up here? One is just one step from being in jail if they had did the proper indictment for her, and the other one is you can't even compare. I'm still looking for the vice presidential debate. I'm sure, I hope it's a 360-degree circle, because if we leave our hands with these two people, I mean, these two people, I don't know what to think of. A lot of, it was nothing like the debates of our president and Clinton and Romney. Nothing like that. The questions were like grammar school, elementary questions, more about character. It was just, it's terrible. And also, I did, at one point when I first started college, wanted to be a journalist. And I know the importance of accuracy. I mean, just imagine someone telling you that 1 + 2 = 4. 1 + 2 = 4, and you never get the correct answer, and you never learn. So I would think that when someone corrects a person, you would want to be corrected, because accuracy and truth are very important in life. I think that's a part of moral character, you know, and I think that, you know, when you look at that, I don't see nothing to get mad at. People get corrected all the time. You know, the Bible says, maybe I shouldn't use the Bible, but anyway, I think that as students, learning students here in America, or just anyone, I wouldn't want no one to give inaccurate information to anybody, or myself, or I would not want to give inaccurate information to anyone. And if it is inaccurate, and I give it out not knowing, and I'm corrected, I should be adult enough to accept it, because if you're not accepting that, they're telling me something is wrong with you, that you don't want to hear accuracy. I don't like fraud. I mean, when you talk about fraud, people say, oh, I can't believe what he says. I mean, he gives erroneous information. And that's the first thing you learn in journalism, that your story to be accurate and non-fraudulent. You can't take stories from other places without really doing your research. So So just know to whoever that person is, I would want to always be accurate. And you want your children and people around you to always be accurate about things, because correction is very, very important in life and in anything. So that's all I have to say. I'm glad to be here today. I was listening to your podcast yesterday about the woman, and also the compensatory, I mean, the racism that you do on Thursdays is so refreshing. And just hi to everybody. And hopefully I'll chime in very, very soon. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you for sharing. The caller at 2899, thank you for your patience, sir. You going to comment?
Yeah, good evening, Gus, and good evening to the audience. I wanted to comment a little on the situation in Brazil. Gus, if you can help me kind of make sure I understood what the gentleman's accent was so thick. I got to be honest, I couldn't catch everything. But is my understanding that they're trying to reclassify the people by color, or is it by heritage or genetics? Heritage. What is this they were trying to do?
From my understanding from the report, they have a commission and they have a test. I forgot the exact name of the test, but they look at the amount of melanin, your skin color, and I guess they have a scale based on how light or how dark you are, and that's how they make an assessment about your racial classification. And it's supposed to be something that they're implementing in hiring decisions and how they're dealing with white supremacy in that part of the world.
So this is an effort to say they want to include darker or more melanated people, I guess is what I think. Is that what we both getting out of this?
This is correct. This is supposed to be some form of compensating or working against white supremacy, okay, racism in Brazil.
Okay. Well, good enough said. I do want to bring attention to, I don't know if you heard recently about the situation over in Darfur where they're dropping chemical bombs on those people over there. According to Al Jazeera, it's supposed to be I think they said Saddam Hussein's regime or something, which I thought Saddam Hussein was dead. Am I correct or not?
That's been reported.
Yeah, I thought so too. Thought you might want to know about that one. Neely Fuller was interesting when he was talking about the accountability. I did want to just ask, you know, is it that he's saying we as a whole can't or shouldn't entertain, you know, asking, you know, public figureheads to, you know, step down or something, or he's saying whoever shouts it first needs to be the one to act on it? Is that what he was saying?
My understanding of that segment, and that is in the archives, people can go back and hear, I think number one is to be make sure that there's no confusion, to be explicit so that people explain what they mean when they use the, I would call cliche, the rhetoric. We need to hold other non-white people accountable to explain what they mean when they say that. And then I thought, even though it is a metaphor, but I mean, even to take it out of that, just how would one victim of racism hold another victim of racism accountable? And asking that in the form of a question, how would you do that while we're still under the system of white supremacy? What is it that you're going to do to this person who is cooperating with, in some way, shape, form, the system of racism, white supremacy? And how do you do that if all non-white people in one way, shape, form, are cooperating with racist man, racist woman, racist child? How do you hold someone accountable for whatever they're doing to cooperate with racists if you yourself are still cooperating with racists? I think that was the question that was posed. If I was able to articulate it clearly, to me that makes logical sense, and that's something that I've said all along. If you're going to hold, quote-unquote, hold someone accountable, then you should maybe start with yourself.
Yeah, I agree. I'm also of the thinking that even if all white people died today, I don't think white supremacy will go away, because I believe it's really deep in us. So I guess we share the same sentiment. the Tulsa riot thing, another young man had called in earlier. I myself am was born and raised in Oklahoma City. The Tulsa riot at one point did get mentioned, but it's like one of them little ads. It gets that like side note. You know, that was about the time I was in junior high when we got a chance to even hear about it. They didn't mention it to the depths of, you know, what we're now starting to hear. It was really told through family members and people who were associated with other members or had family up in Tulsa, because Oklahoma City and Tulsa is very much connected, you know, with, you know, family members. The thing about you getting attacked, you know, for people not wanting to fact check, I just find that ironic. I have a little saying that there's too many people, you know, the irony of a smartphone is it's owned by too many stupid people. You know, we can really take time to research. You know, that's not to knock nobody. That's just to say, you know, you can really research things. You know, you can double check on things. It's the same, measure twice, cut once. Bill Maher, my opinion on him, he's just a refined racist, as I've heard on this network before. I mean, that's just really what I get out of him, always have. One thing I want to bring to people's attention, and somebody did say it earlier, so I just want to, you know, add to it that I think every time I hear the war on ISIS, for me, if you pay attention to the news, somebody of melanin, you know, skin is getting killed. So it's just not even like it should no longer be a guessing game to us who they're talking about, and we shouldn't talk about it as if it's a speculation or, you know, some type of, or who is ISIS. Something else I wanted to bring to your attention, Gus, if you go look at, if you get some time, I tried to look it up again. It was about Wolf Blitzer having much knowledge about what they call ISIS, and this guy challenged him on it. He said he had contacted Israel. He said he wanted to know what ISIS meant, and the guy said, and this is coming from a Israeli Secret Service person, the gentleman said, and Wolf Blitzer was there, he said that ISIS meant Israeli Secret Intelligence Services. And it's funny that if you go look around real deep into old archives of these so-called ISIS leaders being caught, and one thing I always ask people is, how do we know what these so-called ISIS leaders look? Because every time I see them, they got masks covered head to toe. I don't even know how people can call them any, if we're going to identify them by skin hue. So the first time I ever saw one, they had this person in an article, and he was redhead, red beard, and formerly what they call the Ashkenazi Jew. So I was like, okay, this sounds like an infiltration. Another thing is, I want to ask people this year, I know we are traditionalists, but this is one thing, listening to one of your episodes about when you had that gentleman, Christopher Clark, on there, the so-called South African journeyman or whatever he is. I don't know if you remember, but in that episode, he was talking about a white townsman who was a youth mentor, would take the kids out hunting and stuff or whatever, doing like what I call some Boy Scout stuff, which I always feel like is pedophilia act. He referred to that gentleman as Payette, and I don't know what made me just want to go look up that word, but I went and looked up that word, and what I got out of it, I mean, what I was able to translate out of it, it comes from a story. The name comes from a story of Santa Claus and Swart Payette, and Swart Payette means Black Peter. And this is a Danish tradition. If you go online and look this up, Sinterklaas, like sin, and claws. If you go look this up, you'll see all this tradition of white people painting themselves up in blackface with wigs on and stuff. So what I thought about Christopher Clark when y'all was calling him out, I was like, just to use that name made me realize that, yeah, that man is definitely practicing some real refined racism.
I wanted to hop in just because we had somebody else. But we have done more than one program talking about Short Pete. We even had a non-white person call in from the Netherlands, if I remember correctly, where they had a whole campaign about stopping this because they thought it was blatant white supremacy, exactly what he said, whites being in blackface and mocking black people with this whole tradition, racist tradition. Is there anybody that chimed in that we have not heard from, who had a hand up that we have not heard from?
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the other callers. I wanted to comment on, I can't remember who said that it seems like white people are just really revving up and killing black people. From the reading that I've done, after the Civil War, when the Union troops came in, and it looked like they just were not going to be able to keep the black people as slaves, they were slaughtering black people right and left. So, but that was done in response to their realizing that they were getting ready to lose that particular battle. And also the same thing with the Jews in Germany. Once it was like the war was pretty much over, they knew they were losing. But I mean, they really revved up the ovens at that point. I mean, they were really killing people, Jews, as fast as they could at that time. So maybe they're realizing something that we're not realizing, that this is that they're going to lose something. So it's just something I thought. And also, I would like people to keep an eye on, the 13-year-old told me, that asked me, is it a good idea if I take the HPV, the human papillomavirus vaccine? And so someone speaking to him in the schools without, you know, our consent about that, and that worries me because that's targeted at adolescents and pre-adolescent children. It could have a disastrous effect. So, and the other thing is one of the callers mentioned the white student at the HBCU saying, just trying to fit in. Well, that was Thursday night. And the scenario on that was, this week we were supposed to have voter registration for the students at the HBCU because, you know, they're new. They've never voted before. So thousands of these little pushcards that said block party, register to vote, your vote counts, make a difference for Sandra Bland. Thousands of those little cards went out. And the students were supposed to come and register to vote and just have the block party after a fashion show, after 10 o'clock, because, you know, it was on their way back to the dorm. But at the last possible second during the day, this turmoil erupts that a white soccer student, a female soccer student, was sending out social media in blackface, and she was stuffing her pants, you know, to make her behind look big, you know, just being really derogatory. So the students were really upset, and somebody just kept escalating this all day. And so when it was time for them to come over to have their block party and register to vote, instead, the football stadium was brightly lit. And they were told to go over there, and they would talk about this situation, and they would present a front of unity, and they would spell out peace and unity on the football field. And I said, and I really feel like that was the administration's deliberate attempt not to have the students involved. I mean, they've already had two Supreme Court cases because they won't let these black students vote where we live. And I believe it was the administration because, I mean, what, you turn on football lights at a college football stadium? What is that, $20 a minute? So they kept the lights on, and the students just practiced for hours trying to make this people message, and they never came to register to vote. So anyway, I think that was the university. I think they did that deliberately. And the next thing about the mayors, I just figured something out today We have four small hamlets where we live, and all of them have like 6,000 people, 5,000 people. You know, they're not big cities. We're a small place. But one mayor is from, one mayor in one of the hamlets is one of the hamlets where it was a sundown town. So that mayor is Republican. He's white. The others, one is white, he's a Democrat. The other two are black, they're Democrats. But all three of them are being targeted. You can say they're mismanaging money, they're bankrupting their cities, they're instituting usurious policies with the electricity, and all of them are in trouble. And it's just escalating to the point where everybody wants to attack all of these three mayors, not the one in the white hamlet, but these three Democratic, primarily black hamlets. They want it. I have a feeling that the DA is revving this up so you can throw them all in jail. So what we have to do is de-escalate that, because he'll just round them all up, and that'll be the end of it. But I just realized that each town is incensed, and they want to just rip into their mayors, but it's only the mayors, the towns with the that are non-white. And I just finally figured out the whole picture. I was just so slow. So anyway, I just wanted to share that, my thing on mayors, and then what happened at the HBCU.
That is pretty important about the disruption of the effort to get folks registered and getting more younger black people to vote, regardless of how folks feel about the whole voting situation, but to get them distracted, and particularly to go out and participate in some, I would say that is questionable. I don't know the value if we're supposed to arrange ourselves, and I don't know how that's going to solve any problems. But that, in my view, very suspicious, and I would tend to agree with your thoughts that could have been something organized by white faculty members or whomever at the university to divert them away from what you all had planned, what had been organized to get more folks to register. That's right in Sandra Bland's area, Prairie View, the HBCU where this took place, where the alleged white race soldier, she was doing all this tackiness and posting these images. Anybody that we missed completely? Anybody that we missed have commentary they wanted to get
in? Good evening.
Greetings.
Yes, my name is Kwabena. I just had some thoughts that I wanted to share with the group. Just recently, I was driving and I was thinking, you know, what are some actions that a black person living in the United States could take that could potentially not only save lives, but also to register our displeasure with our current situation with the law enforcement community. My background, I'm a military veteran. I also work in the medical field. And so I thought back to my time in Iraq, and I thought, okay, what were some of the strategies we were using there as individuals to try to keep ourselves from getting killed over there? And I remember that we had to wear body armor. We have to wear bulletproof vest. Basically, it was part of the uniform. You couldn't be caught outside without a bulletproof vest. And I thought about it, and it kind of started to seem like a, you know, like a little funny joke. But the more I thought about it, the more it made sense to me. Why? Because if it's raining outside, you would be wise to grab an umbrella or a rain jacket and be out there so that it doesn't rain on you, you don't get soaked. And if it's raining bullets out there, then you'd be even wiser to put on a bulletproof vest. And then I started to observe basically how people were shot, you know, where the shots were landing. And they are what we call in the military body center of mass, which means you're getting shot in the torso. So if bulletproof vest became a part of the black American clothing experience in the United States, I believe it will do more than just save life. It will even register loudly to the rest of the global community of how we as a people do not feel protected. It will strike a conversation with your white counterparts to let them see you in a state where you do not feel protected and have them go home and discuss with their families how their one black co-worker comes to work in a bulletproof vest because they do not feel safe in their world. And I think that is the clearest message that could be sent out based on the actions that we take. And, you know, I picture myself and my family just going out grocery shopping in bulletproof vests and having people looking at us and thinking, what is wrong with these people? And then, you know, we can tell them clearly what we feel. We are feeling targeted. We are behind enemy lines. And in a situation of war, this is the most prudent thing to do. Now, bulletproof vests are not cheap. You know, I looked into it, and they pretty much cost as much as Air Jordans. But I believe that in Chicago or anywhere else, if that was part of the daily attire, many people would not go down in the hail of bullets that we've been seeing. And so I wanted to put that thought out there. It seems a little excessive, but I think that is a very prudent thing to do. Sure, not many of us are going to run into the bullets, but again, it will come in very handy when that nervous white cop pulled that trigger on your chest. It will stop it. And hopefully you have a minute to for him to calm himself down and you go ahead. Thank you.
Yeah, minor one. One comment that came to mind, just really showing the impact that Dr. Valerie Yerger's work had, and I think they've said for years now that they don't accurately track the number of people that get shot and killed by enforcement officials on a regular basis. The Washington Post, they have been tracking that number. From the statistics that they have from 2016, and the Washington Post, they also allegedly have numbers from 2015. It's not even 1,000 black people are shot and killed by police on a yearly basis. It's not even 1,000. I'm going to say 10,000 just for argument's sake, but I mean, that is like a gross misrepresentation of all the numbers that I've seen. Someone would have to step forward with some evidence that, you know, that many black people are dying from being shot directly by police on a yearly basis. But I'll just say 10,000 for argument's sake, even though I know that's way over every number I've seen. Okay. 45,000 black people die per year from cigarettes, cigarette-related illnesses. That was Dr. Valerie Yerger's work. Just if you want to put a comparison in terms of what you are more likely to have a problem with in the system of racism, white supremacy, cigarettes kill way more black people per year than enforcement officers. In terms of total war against black people, the police, that is one aspect of it. But I mean, there are many, 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 many things that are way more lethal than police killing black people on a yearly basis, unless people have evidence to prove otherwise.
Also, it should be noted that having body armor in some jurisdiction is against the law. And I do believe that there is an effort by lawmakers in some jurisdictions to completely outlaw the purchase of body armor totally. So I think that should be noted.
I think Connecticut is one such state where it's not legal. Have to check. I'm not a Connecticut resident. Have never been to Connecticut, but I think that is one state where it is not legal to have body armor if you're a civilian. We have a little less than 5 minutes. Anything folks wanted to get in? I was going to ask, just I guess my quick statement, the Keith Lamont Scott thing, they have evolved in how they are dealing with this case. Not only was he smoking weed or rolling a joint, and did he have a firearm? Now the reports that they've had this week widespread were that his partner had previously feared that he was going to be violent and that he had brutalized or threatened to brutalize some of the family members. So that's the latest aspect of it. I think it will be very, very unlikely that anyone will be charged for his shooting death from a week ago. But that's the the latest aspect, the cannabis included. And just FYI, even if cannabis was legal on a federal basis or in the state of North Carolina, if they legalize it the way it has been done here in Washington State and Colorado and some of the other areas, even if you are smoking cannabis in your vehicle, that would not be legal. That is not legal here in Washington State, even though they legalized recreational use of cannabis. That would still be a reason for enforcement officials to harass, kill black people. Anybody have anything else they want to get in before we conclude?
Can I be yes.
We'll get retired fighter and then Thomas in New York.
Yes, I just remembered looking at an associate's post, and someone had on his Facebook, and someone had on an incident to where as non-white black male refused to give the enforcement official his insurance. You know how they ask for, you know, your proof of insurance and registration, and I believe maybe the license also. And the justification on his behalf was because, you know, by reaching for something, we know what can happen. He just went by the task of paying the tickets in court. So I just put down there as a comment. I said, well, we just witnessed one victim of racism, white supremacy's attempt at codification. And I just said right on, you know, to it, you know, basically everybody else was, you know, wow. We're in a new reality. But I attempted to remind them that we've been terrorized by the global system of racist white supremacy ever since its establishment, which was not a couple of days ago. And that was one victim's attempt to establish some sort of codification to avoid instant death, the possibility of instant death. So I just thought it was interesting that he went through that particular strategy to attempt to avoid not getting killed. That's all I had.
Did you say he didn't show proof of insurance? Did I hear that correctly? He just paid the court tickets and didn't show his proof of insurance.
Right, right. By not reaching into his glove compartment or wherever it was, you know, you get citations for it. And it turned. I assume what happened. Not assume because that's what had on the post that he gladly paid. Just went and paid for the tickets. Due to it, as opposed to I'm not going to be reaching for that. It was posted.
Wow.
And I just stated, hey, that was his version of codified. I really can't argue with it, you know, standpoint, because there have been plenty of examples, and I'm sure it's before these things were being put on TV and on enforcement officials video lapel that you can get killed, and that's his strategy. You know, so either VGQ or that was his codified attempt to avoid instant death, the possibility anyway.
I don't have a critique. I would say that is for sure jurisdiction specific in Georgia. That is an arrestable offense immediately. Failure to show proof of insurance, you can go to jail right now. That is subject to officer discretion. I don't know if it's like that. My suspicion would be that is probably another one that, depending on the population of black people, percentage of population, that they are more draconian with those type of offenses, where if we have a whole lot of black people that live in this area, that's the sort of thing that we'll just say, okay, you go to jail immediately if you don't have proof of insurance. But I know there are a whole lot of people in Atlanta specifically who end up in greater confinement. That is the charge, failure to show proof of insurance. Thomas in New York.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that.
For sure, that law, it's difficult to know. It depends. The laws change so much depending on where you happen to
be. Well, it's not that way in Florida, because I about maybe a couple of months ago, didn't show my insurance, proof of insurance. And so
right.
I guess it's not in Florida.
Thomas in New York, thank you for your patience, sir. Did you have a comment you wanted to get in?
I did. I just wanted to first say on this right here, I know in New York and New Jersey, you go to jail for not having insurance, but if I'm not mistaken, Florida is one of those states where you don't need insurance to drive. I don't think, my relatives who live down there, that it's not mandatory that they have to have auto insurance. And I wanted to add that I have a friend who did 4 years for having a vest in New Jersey. He bought a bulletproof vest. He thought he was cool. He wore it outside one day. Cops saw him with it, pulled over, and I didn't see him until 4 years later. So it's illegal in some states.
Absolutely. That, as I stated, you would definitely have to do some checking to find out what the rules, regulations happen to be in your part of the world. They do, it's been my experience, racists can make it very difficult to know all the rules, procedures, regulations, and that just another means of making it difficult to ascertain truth so we can make the best possible decisions to keep ourselves safe. It has been 3. We will be back this week. You have to check the Black Talk Radio Network page so that I can see the calendar to see exactly the dates, times for the programs that are coming up for this week. Just check. You can check the Facebook page as well for all of the upcoming broadcasts. If you have questions, gripes, guest suggestions, feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. I think the vice presidential debate is coming up this week. I'm sure there'll be a good bit of commentary about that as well. If anything else comes through, just let us know, and we'll be looking forward to hearing from folks in a matter of days. We have the book study coming up on Friday. Workplace Racism on Thursday. I am sure we'll be broadcasting before this coming Thursday. I hope folks are able to remain as safe as possible. No narcotics, alcohol, all that came up within the course of the discussion today. I would just state again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I think that is one thing right there where you would not have to spend $200 or more to purchase a device to try to help us stay safe. In fact, you could save some money, the money that, you know, might be allocated for whatever, alcohol, cigarettes, cannabis, anything else whites come out with. That's money that could be saved. That is probably, I would say it's no probably to it, that is directly, indirectly going to be going to racists to further terrorize us. That's one thing we could do right there. We're going to be sober, make sure that we are clear thinking enough to make phenomenal decisions to keep ourselves as safe as possible. I would just state again, if you're going to be in a vehicle, it seems like even if you're going to be in a parked vehicle, you do not want to be under the influence of anything and have that be the day that you bump into Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw, race soldier, badge or no. That can be an instant life-ending, life-altering situation. You want to be at your codified best so that you can make phenomenal decisions. And even understanding, even if you do make phenomenal decisions, that can still end badly. Again, race soldier bad or no, race soldier badge or no. So just have that in mind. I think that is just one thing that we could do that would have a phenomenal impact and would send a message. I mean, folks talking about doing something that sends a signal to racist man, racist woman, racist child about our behavior changing and our behavior reflecting that war is being waged against black people worldwide. Man, we are going to be sober 24/7 until this problem has been solved. With that, thanks for everyone tuning in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening, and we will be back directly. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all. for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Hey, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.